I'm going to call to order a regular meeting of the Gilbert Beach City Council for Monday, November 2nd, 2015. And would you all please stand with us in a moment of silence for the brave men and women who sacrifice every day so that we may enjoy our freedoms? Thank you. Remain standing. One of the favorite parts of our meeting is that we get the youth involved. And so tonight, to lead us in the flag salute, we have David Patrick. David is 12 years old and a sixth grade student at Gilbert Beach Elementary School. He loves acquiring new knowledge each year at school. He likes living near the beach because he enjoys swimming and boogie boarding. David likes working outdoors, using his abilities to take things apart to see how they work. When he is older, David is also interested in becoming a paramedic to help others. That's a noble profession, David. Keep it up. He loves sports. He currently plays football and baseball in the spring, and at recess, he plays soccer and basketball. I believe David is accompanied tonight by his dad?
And teacher.
And teacher. Okay. Not principal, but I see dad Kurt, right? So don't be shy, Kurt. Come up and get as many pictures as you like. David, whenever you're ready.
Hands over your heart. Ready, begin.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
And David, I have a certificate for you coming forward tonight. Thank you very much again for the giving us a flag salute. I think we've got a young lady over there who wants to take a picture. And there's some supplies. And shake all the way.
Thank you very much. Nice to meet you.
Nice. Thank you, Dave.
They won't buy.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much. Great job.
Oh, you want to stand right in front? Okay. Oh, come closer.
You got it. Thanks
again, David. Keep up the great work in school. Okay, Donna, when you're ready, roll call, please.
Here.
Thank you, Donna. City Attorney, will you cover our closed session announcements tonight?
Thank you, Honorable Mayor, Council Member. At the last council meeting on October 19th, council met in closed session on three items. First one being the labor or real property negotiations pertaining to Pacific companies. The second and third one being labor negotiations with all of the groups. Bargaining groups in the city. After convening back into open session, it was reported that no reportable actions were taken by the council in closed session.
Very good. Thank you, City Attorney. Let's move on to agenda review. This is where the council will review the agenda as presented by staff and see if we want to make any changes to the agenda. So at this point, City Manager, did you have anything that you wanted to add?
Yes, Mr. Mayor. PG&E had requested a time on the agenda to make a presentation regarding their LED street lighting upgrade. And originally, staff had scheduled that meeting for November 16th. Unfortunately, Mr. Daniels, the representative from PG&E, couldn't be at that meeting. So consequently, I'm going to recommend and suggest that you allow Mr. Daniels to complete that presentation under public comments, extend a little bit of time to him. He does have a PowerPoint, and we've distributed that to you.
Okay. So thank you for that, Bob. And if it is a pleasure of the council to make that change, because I, even though this is only information,
right,
because I work for PG&E, I think it would be wise of me to recuse myself when that moment comes.
Yes.
Okay. So at that, with that, do any members of the council want to make any other changes, or are you okay with what is suggested by the city manager?
I'll make a motion that we
go forward with the agenda as presented and including the presentation by PG&E.
Second.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? None. And I'm going to vote aye on all and abstain on the PG&E item just for conservative sake. How's that? Very good. All right. Let's see. Our ceremonial calendar tonight, there are no items on that, which brings us to public communications. I don't have any speaker request forms to speak during public communications, but is there someone who would like to come forward and address item or any item that is in the jurisdiction of this council? But please bear in mind we cannot make any decisions on any item that is not on the agenda. Okay, seeing no one come forward, I'm going to close public communications, and I think at this point I'm going to turn the gavel over to Mayor Pro Tem Lee, and I'm sure you will give me ample opportunity to leave the room since I'm still injured.
And that'll give our financial director time to bring up the PowerPoint. With that, City Manager, was there any preamble that you wanted to provide? Or?
No, as just briefly in introducing Mr. Daniels, he's a representative from PG&E. They're about to undertake an upgrade of the streetlights. By the way, the majority of the streetlights in the city are actually owned by PG&E. And so consequently, they're going to be upgrading to the LED energy-saving devices, and Mr. Daniels is here to make a presentation about that.
Thank you very much. Mr. Daniels, the floor is yours.
Mr. Mayor Pro Tem and Council, thank you so much, staff as well. Have some good news for you today, and happy to share it with you on about only four slides, so I'll be very brief. PG&E will be replacing the non-decorative streetlights here in Grover Beach with light-emitting diodes, better known as the LEDs. They will produce about 50% to 75% less energy, or use up about 50% to 75% less energy. They will cost the same for the wattage equivalent, and they will last about four times longer. They will provide more natural light and better visibility, and they will use less energy per light, reducing greenhouse gases and the carbon footprint here in Grover Beach. We are currently scheduling to do this retrofit in the late fall, and times have fluctuated, so I don't want to give you a precise time, but staff will be made aware of it, as well as the residents, and I'll get to that in a moment. There are approximately 487 fixtures that we will be addressing. These are the Cobra heads. So they're not the decorative lights. If we have any decorative lights that PG&E owns in the city, we're not going to be dealing with those in this program, only those Cobra heads that PG&E owns. You'll see a single bucket truck working this project with a two-person crew. And then there'll be about, it takes about less than 10 minutes to do the retrofit on each light. Once they're up there, there's some time to set up and do it, but it's rather quick. Parking and traffic should not be impacted, and of course we'll abide by all established rules and restrictions with respect to that. If we do block traffic, we'll do proper traffic planning on that. And we should be, once we begin, completed in about 3 to 4 weeks with some wiggle room there. We will be doing extensive outreach about a week to two prior to our mobilization. Residents will be advised with some mailing material. We'll also have websites and videos available. There'll be some press releases that'll go out. So the community should be well aware that this will be happening. And also there'll be a post installation survey as well sent to customers about 2 to 4 weeks out. And there'll be ample information provided for residents to be able to call and ask questions as well. And some of the materials that you'll be seeing, or the residents will be seeing that will be coming out, will look like this. I've also left a copy of the PowerPoint in the back of the room, as well as a flyer that I've added for you that has some more information. And in fact, this does have the website where one can go for information. We will also be working with the city's public works director and staff as a whole, to work with them so that when customers or constituents do call into the City Hall asking questions, because they may not know the greater picture here, we'll be working with them to provide a number that they can then be transferred to or sent to so that they can get their questions answered. And I think with that, I want to thank you. I'll be happy to answer any questions. We have met with staff on this already, so they're well aware of it. And we're ready to proceed. And we just want to make sure you and the community start to get the knowledge about it. Any questions?
Great. Thank you for that that presentation. Any questions? We'll start with Councilmember Shaw.
I had one question. Hi, Eric.
Hi, how are you?
I am very excited about this project. I have been walking home recently in the dark. I know we were walking home from the Ramona Park after the Halloween thing, and also walking up 10th from Ramona Park and also walking up 9th from the Exploration Station. It is pitch black. Like, you can't even see the sidewalk. So I'm hoping that this really helps with the brighter lights.
Are there lights already there?
No.
Okay, that's a question for city staff. To add extra lights is a different, that's not part of this program, but that is something that we can work with staff on if the city decides that they'd like to add more lights in an area that needs it.
Okay.
But what can be done with this program is that if there's an area where there already is a Cobra head light and city staff decides, or you know, through whatever conversations you have, decide that that's an area where you might want a little bit brighter light, we can afford to do, or this program affords that opportunity at no extra cost at this time. If in the future the city does want to make a change to one of these lights with a higher illumination in that particular area, then there would be a city cost. But we are offering to do that right now, so we're all waiting for the staff to get back to us on any of those spots that they deem that they'd like to increase the illumination or decrease it for other particular reasons.
Okay. Oh, okay. So we might have some options on 9th.
You do have
and
some options. On the darkness where there is no light, this program doesn't cover that.
Yeah, I'll have to go look again. I mean, there were lights. It's just between lights, there was nothing.
Well, this may help with that if there are lights in that area.
Great. Thank you.
Depends on how far apart they are.
Councilmember Bright.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you for being here.
You bet.
This is something that a lot of our residents have been asking for for a very long time. So so then you're confident that it is going to make it will be a brighter light?
It's a crisper light. It's a much brighter light. I will invite you to go to San Luis Obispo or Santa Maria. They own their own lights, and through a different program that took place a year and a half ago, they have retrofitted all of their Cobra heads to the LEDs. I live in San Luis, so when you're there, you can markedly see a difference in the color, the illumination, and the reduction in light pollution.
That's good to know. So a Cobra head, how would you identify that? Is there some way?
We can explain it to you.
Okay.
But there clearly is a difference.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very good. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Councilmember Nichols.
Nothing. Thank you.
Great. Then actually, I just had one more question for you, and I think Councilmember Shaw asked my question with regards to the brightness and the kind of the what's next step. My question has to do with a deadline for a decision on your part. So when would you need to know from our staff, whether it's the police chief or the city engineer, as to when those either the up lighting or the down lighting?
We'd want that to come through the city manager's office
right to
us, but or through the public director's office if that's how he so deems. But this program is moving. The other communities in this area that will also receive these lights are some areas in the county, also Rio Grande and Pismo Beach. There is an effort to try to do this before the end of the year. In order to accomplish that goal, we need to make the orders. And in order to make the orders, we need to know if the city wants to make any alterations to that illumination that I talked about, whether you want a brighter one in this particular spot or a less bright one in that particular spot. We cannot make the order until we know that, so we are waiting on city staff. They have a copy of the inventory, and we're waiting on them to get back to us with that information.
Okay. So, Mr. City Manager, if we gave a deadline internally of...
Well, we've already done some work on it. You know, we've talked about it at the staff level. We should be ready in about a week.
Okay.
That's excellent.
Does that work for
PG? Yes, thank you very much.
Great. Okay. Great, thank you. I know this isn't a presentation. This is a presentation item, but I will open it up to anyone from the audience if they wanted to have any public comment on that. And
Or questions.
So, seeing no one come forward, Mr. Daniels, thank you very much.
Thank you, and thank you for adding me to the agenda. I appreciate it very much.
Great, thank you. And with that, Mr. Police Chief, if you were, or Chief, would you let the mayor know that he can join us again?
You
should. Exactly. We'll just kind of continue without him. No, we probably should bring him back. So. Okay.
Good. Okay, so we're going to move into our public hearings tonight, and this is item number one on the agenda. If you don't have a copy, there are copies on this table at the back of the room. This is an appeal with Planning Commission denial of development permit number 14-21. So, Mr. Buckingham, are you doing the staff report?
Ms. Reese will begin.
Okay, Ms. Reese, you have the floor.
Good evening. On September 16th, the Planning Commission considered a request for a development permit to construct a three-unit plan unit development on a vacant parcel located on South Oak Park Boulevard. After conducting the public hearing, the Commission focused on two main issues. The first issue of primary concern was that the proposed access design from Oak Park Boulevard would create an unsafe situation for residents entering or exiting the project or the adjacent project to the south, or vehicles, bicycles, and pedestrians in the vicinity of the proposed driveway. The second issue was related to architectural compatibility of Unit 3, which would be accessed from Cranberry Street. There were two members of the public that spoke during the public hearing citing this concern. One of them emailed her concerns to the city earlier today, and that is before you on the dais. The commission discussed the issue, including concerns about the roof deck, and made a finding that Unit 3 was not consistent with Land Use Element Policy 3.1 for architectural compatibility. Therefore, the commission was unable to make the necessary findings to approve the project based on the safety concerns for circulation on Oak Park Boulevard and the architectural incompatibility of Unit 3. With the adjacent Berry Gardens project. The property owner's representative appealed the Planning Commission's decision to the council, and staff is requesting the council consider the appeal of the Planning Commission's denial for the development permit tonight. The subject site is primarily an undeveloped lot. The southerly and easterly property lines are also the city boundary lines for Rio Grande and Grover Beach. The westerly property line fronts Oak Park Boulevard, and the easterly property line fronts Cranberry and Blackberry Streets in Rio Grande. The site is zoned R3 high density residential, as are the properties to the north and south. Whoops. The neighborhood is composed of detached single-family residences to the east, attached single-family residences to the south, and multifamily residential buildings to the north and the west. The three-lot subdivision and construction of a three-unit plan unit development project is proposed. Units 1 and 2 would be accessed from Oak Park Boulevard, and Unit 3 would be accessed from Cranberry Street in Rio Grande. This is Unit 3 over here. A 5-foot wide easement runs along the entire south property line for private access and utilities. The existing driveway serving the development to the south is 21 feet wide, with 5 feet of it located on the applicant's lot within that 5-foot easement. As proposed, the residences would be two-story and approximately 25 feet in height, and include an attached two-car garage, second-floor deck, and a roof deck. There are three general plan land use element policies regarding infill development that are applicable to the project. Land use element policy 3.1 regarding compatibility related to architecture, privacy, and materials and or colors. 20.9 regarding the height of development, and 20.8 regarding qualities desired in residential development. Staff did provide notice to the notice of the project to the City of Aurora Grande, and their staff provided comments on the project. After deliberating, the commission had concerns about the architectural compatibility of Unit 3 and were unable to make a finding of consistency with Policy 3.1. Although there were potential design solutions discussed by the commission, no specific changes were recommended. The applicant's representative also indicated a willingness to make the design make design revisions to Unit 3. Public Works Director Ray will now discuss the issue related to access from Oak Park Boulevard.
That's close. Good evening, Honorable Mayor and Council. So the project needs to provide a driveway to access units 1 and 2 from Oak Park Boulevard. And based on city standards, driveway widths, the driveway apron width, which is the part of the driveway in the city sidewalk, can vary between 10 feet minimum and 24 feet maximum. And then when driveways are located adjacent to each other at the property lines, there needs to be 2 feet of full height curb between driveways. The applicant is proposing to construct the driveway in Oak Park adjacent to and connected to the existing driveway to the south. And so what you see is a 34-foot driveway apron, which is, the part of the driveway in the sidewalk, serving a 36-foot wide driveway. And there's a number of issues related to that. First of all, Oak Park Boulevard is identified as a minor arterial and a truck route. And it's in the circulation element, posted speed limits are 30 miles per hour in southbound direction and about 35 miles per hour northbound. In 2025, the estimated traffic volume is about 5,000 average daily trips. There are two travel lanes in the northbound direction. Can we move to the exhibit shows the travel lanes, if possible? It's useful. Just want to make sure you can see this while I'm talking about it. There we go. That's a Google Earth aerial, but you can see jumping back. There's two travel lanes in the northbound direction and with a Class 2 bike lane and no street parking south of the proposed driveway, and then there's parking with no Class 2 bike line north of the proposed access driveway. So there's some confusion going on with parking beginning and ending bike lanes beginning and ending right near the project. In the southbound direction, the road transitions from two lanes at West Grand Avenue. I can point to that. You have the pointer? Did I lose it? There it is. Sorry, let me try this. So here we go. And coming from Oak Park Boulevard, the road transitions from two lanes to a single lane and then back to two lanes just past what would be the project entrance here. Adjacent to the project, you'll see the raised center median here. You can just see the very edge of it right here, going to a double striped center median, and here again on the other side. There's some issues with that raised median also. So since there's no center turn lane, the only way to basically access this property in the southbound direction coming from West Grand Avenue is to essentially stop in the single travel lane or to actually drive across the double yellow lines, which would be, of course, illegal from the vehicle code standpoint, and to basically park in the center median there waiting for a clear access to cross to the driveway. In order to maintain the functional characteristics of Oak Park Boulevard and to provide for safe vehicle, pedestrian, and bicycle uses, I think it's very important that access to Oak Park Boulevard by private driveways be carefully controlled. Excessively wide driveways are known to result in excess vehicle speeds entering the driveway, especially from an arterial roadway, and there's a significant increase in risk to vehicles, pedestrians, and bicyclists. The 36-foot-wide single driveway proposed by the applicant actually exacerbates those risks, because if you could imagine a pedestrian or a bicyclist crossing the entire width of that driveway, they have to basically transition across all 36 feet while multiple turning movements, vehicles coming in and out in two different directions from the driveway, vehicles trying to access both northbound and southbound, and potentially from Manhattan Boulevard, are all trying to use the same space without even a two-foot landing in there for at least a safe pedestrian or bicycle refuge. And although the driveway, the 36-foot driveway, may appear to function as a single shared driveway, it legally cannot be used as a single shared driveway. The 21-unit project to the south would only have legal use of the southerly 23 feet, which includes 18 feet on their lot and 5 feet that's a shared access easement, which you can see here is a shared access easement. And then the project we're talking about tonight would only have legal access to the 18 feet in here. And yet, with no delineation between the two driveways, it's very likely that they would end up sharing them. So, I'm going to jump past that. So again, the city standard requires a minimum of 2-foot standard height curb between the driveways. And this is primarily to provide a safe refuge for pedestrians between the driveways and also to provide clear demarcation between the driveways adjacent to each other. So looking at this project, staff cannot support the proposed driveway, the proposed 34-foot wide shared driveway. And that is based on the following. The proposed driveway is designed to serve the existing and proposed project creates an unsafe situation as a result of the number of conflicting vehicle movements at this location. The existing access to the 21-unit project has no safe refuge for vehicles traveling southbound to turn into the existing project. The proposed project would add 2 additional units, which would exacerbate that existing condition. Widening of the existing driveway to 36 feet is not a legally created shared driveway. And again, there's no delineation. I believe there's some alternatives that are possible. And those alternatives would be to either reach an agreement with the existing project to the south to actually share the driveway in the existing width, to, in fact, relocate the driveway to create the 2-foot separation between the two driveways, or to relocate the driveway to the northern portion of the lot. And looking at those options, again, I think it's important to consider the number of conflicting traffic movements. So in your staff report, you'll see this exhibit. And each color is identifying a unique and separate traffic movement at this location of the driveway. And every time those arrows cross, those are conflicting vehicle movements. I'll point to here, where here's a vehicle in the lane waiting to turn southbound into one or the other driveway. They could turn into, since they can't legally share the driveway, they'd be turning into one of two locations. Vehicles traveling southbound behind them would have a potential rear-end conflict. Otherwise, not recognizing the vehicle needs to stop abruptly, they could run into them. Those vehicles attempting to enter the driveway southbound could conflict with vehicles turning southbound out of either driveway, either side of the driveway, northbound out of either side of the driveway, and potentially vehicles from Manhattan trying to turn northbound or southbound onto Oak Park Boulevard. Additional conflicts include just the volume of traffic northbound on Oak Park Boulevard. So looking at all those traffic conflicts, in the opinion of your public works director and city engineer, the only proposal, the only option that makes sense and that I can support would be to relocate the driveway to the north side of the property and to basically modify the development to access from that location. So that concludes my portion of the presentation. I'll return it back to Janet, and if you have any questions, I'm available.
In order to approve the proposed project, all three of the required findings must be made in the affirmative. The commission could not make the first finding, which is this one. The proposed development is consistent with the general plan, development code, and other city goals, policies, and standards as applicable. They could not make this finding, citing that Unit 3 was not architecturally compatible with the adjacent Berry Gardens project. The second finding is site is physically suitable in terms of design, location, operating characteristics, shape, size, and topography. The third finding, the site suitability ensures that proposal would not constitute a hazard to the public interest, health, safety, or welfare. The Planning Commission could not make this finding, indicating that the project will create an unsafe condition as a result of the multiple vehicular, bicycle, and pedestrian conflicts in the vicinity of the proposed driveway. In conclusion, the Commission was unable to make the findings required to approve the project and denied the project on a 3-0 vote. Staff has identified some options for the Council's consideration. The Council could uphold the action of the Planning Commission, overturn the action of the Commission, or provide alternative direction. If the Council determined that the required findings to approve the project as designed can be made, then the Council would provide staff with the basis of the findings and direct staff to return with a resolution granting the appeal with the conditions of approval for consideration. And that concludes staff's presentation.
Thank you, staff. Let's questions only. Councilmember Nichols, any questions?
It seems to me that just from the first photographs that trying to put three homes on that strip, which is facing another strip of development that only has two homes in that same space, is overcrowding the whole site to begin with, which is not a question, it's just an observation.
Okay. Councilmember Shaw.
I was looking while you were speaking through my materials, and I just couldn't find what would be the widest appropriate driveway permitted, because I know this one is much too wide. I mean, as one of the issues.
The city standards for a residential driveway is 24 feet wide.
So if there, I mean, I know you'd still have the traffic issues, but aside from the traffic issues, the width right now is 10 feet too wide.
Correct.
Okay. And I guess my questions are more maybe for the builder or designer, okay, just as far as why the alternatives proposed might not work. So I'm not sure if you guys can answer that or will.
You want to withhold
that.
Yeah, because we'll allow him, the appellate, to come up. Councilmember Bright.
Thank you. I really just have one clarification, please. So even if the applicant was to create a demarcation between the two driveways, or the existing and the proposed driveways, you still would not feel comfortable supporting this project as it is?
All of that option would, at its very basic level, meet the city standard requirement. No, I wouldn't support it, primarily because of the location of the driveway. As you move the driveway slightly to the north, but still try to access it southbound from Oak Park Boulevard, you're basically creating a vehicle code issue. You really would be tempted to pull into this center median. Double stripe median actually acts as a raised median. You have to consider it that way. And so your temptation would be either to stop traffic, potential rear end collisions, or pull illegally into the center median. And then the same number of vehicle conflicts exist just because of the proximity of the two driveways. When you're looking at an arterial like this, it's much better to control the access and have it evenly spaced rather than have the access ways clustered together.
So I had read somewhere where there was maybe some discussion about a no left turn sign.
Yes, so in presenting this to the Planning Commission, some options that we considered would be to essentially study that area and see if it, with a traffic engineer, to determine if it was possible to create a left-hand turn lane by either removing portions of the landscaped and striped median, and that's possible, or if that wasn't possible, to create a no left-hand turn. I think the concern with the no left-hand turn sign is, however, that people traveling southbound would then be convinced or might be convinced to just simply go around the median and make a U-turn. And again, on an arterial, you know, Oak Park, we're trying to preserve the functional classification of it as an arterial. That would not be recommended to create U-turns down there.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Mayor Pro Tem Lee.
Thank you for that. I have the first question has to do with the compatibility of Unit 3. So in reading through the Berry Gardens architectural review and so forth, and looking at the testimony or the minutes, there was some discussion that the architecture of Unit 3 could become compatible with Berry Gardens. So if we did go forward with a recommendation for approval on this, that could be added as a condition of approval?
Correct. The council could give more specific direction about the, you know, compatibility issue, whether that would be materials, or there was discussion about the roof deck as well. There's different ways that could be treated to alleviate what that was coined the industrial look.
Okay. And so we could do that if we did go in that direction to provide some certainty to Arroyo Grande that we're compatible with Berry Gardens, and some certainty to the developer that he has a direction to go forward with regards to architecture.
Correct. And the applicant did indicate willingness to make some modifications, but again, he did not offer anything specific at the Planning Commission meeting.
Okay. So that specifically could be done during the building permit process, though, correct? So that would be left up to planning and building staff effectively to say this meets the intent, and then if there's a disagreement, it comes back to the council. How would that work?
I would think that the council would want to give some direction. You could either have the project come back for your final review. It would be one option to assure that the changes are proper.
Okay.
Hold on a second. I think the city attorney wants to weigh in.
Appreciate it, Honorable Mayor, Council Members. I think my recommendation would be that if leaving aside the first two findings, if this is the only one that's in question, first of all, that you obtain a commitment from the applicant that he is willing to do the things that would be outlined, because if he's not, he certainly has other remedies, and you would then simply just move forward with denying the project based on that condition alone. And once he expresses that willingness, then you would be in a position to basically impose a condition of approval. This is a de novo review, which condition would need to be met, and the determination as to whether or not that condition is met would be left then at the director's discretion. And any disputes would then ultimately come back to you. But there would not be a need for another formal hearing before you, unless there was some dispute as to whether or not the director exercised his discretion correctly.
Okay, great. Thank you. On that item, I have a question with regards to the circulation item as well. Was there any discussion, and I didn't see any, so I wasn't sure if there was some thought. Actually, if you can go back to the last image, if you would, please. Thank you, Janet. I see there's parking in front of the parcel, and yet below that there's the Class 2 bike lane to the south. So was there any discussion about continuing that Class 2 bike lane through the property, removing the parking, and potentially extending the refuge lane in the middle to the two-way left turn lane to provide turning movements into the property, realizing we still have the driveway issue and compatibility to hash out or to figure out what the best course of that direction is. But was there any discussion about changing striping on Oak Park?
We didn't get into the details of, you know, the particulars, parking, bike lane, you know, left turn refuge or two-way left turn lane or something like that. But what we did consider and offer as a recommendation is that if the Planning Commission at that time wanted to consider the two driveways located adjacent to each other in compliance with the city standard, that a traffic study should be conducted at the expense of the applicant to consider if, in fact, a safe turning movement could be created there. And that, so that would include, or as an example, would include development of a left turn lane, perhaps removing the parking near the project, perhaps extending the Class 2 bike lane. But that is left to a discussion if, in fact, that became the option selected.
Okay. Thank you. That's all I had for now. I did have some questions for the applicant.
Okay.
As he comes forward.
Very good. Staff, I know you went through the required findings, and the first one was talking about consistency with the general plan, development code, and other goals and policies. Can you kind of walk us through? I see there's a table in here, and I'm not struggling with it. I'm a recovering planner, so I understand this. But will you? It seems to me in my reading of this of the staff report that this project as proposed appears to meet the vast majority, if not all, of the standards and whatnot. Correct?
Correct. I mean, there are only really two issues with the driveway configuration. One is just that it's unsafe, as discussed by the Public Works Director in his professional opinion. And then technically, because the standard is 24 feet max, when you combine these things, technically it exceeds the standards.
Okay.
You're correct. Other than that, again, the density, there's no other issues with this project.
So can you walk me, what's the allowed density on this project? On this site?
You could actually have 6 units on this site.
Okay. And they're proposing?
3.
Do they meet all the setbacks?
Yes.
What is the maximum height requirement?
32 feet.
Okay. And when the commission was discussing this on the neighborhood compatibility, did the issue come up that you got condominiums to the north of this, or was it mostly what was in Berry Gardens? And the condos happen to be in the city of Grover Beach, and want to make sure there's a distinction.
Right. The compatibility issue was strictly on the east side adjacent to the Berry Gardens single-family detached homes. So
the compatibility issue was more one of architecture, not necessarily scale?
Correct. The only thing that I think you could argue, they were had concerns about the way the roof deck was constructed. It creates more of a vertical facade at the top rather than having a roof line that would extend back at a typical 412 pitch.
Okay.
So again, real design, easy design solutions for those issues.
Okay. And have you seen a situation in which development occurring in one city is next to another jurisdiction? And I saw the letter from the city of Rio Grande, and I have to tell you, we want to be respectful when someone writes letters and writes shall in there. In this community, I have to say my antenna went way up. So have we seen a situation where another community can, because when we say shall, that's a mandate, so
right.
I'm just curious.
No, another city cannot require their development standards upon a project that's in another city.
Okay.
As you're mentioning, we provide it to them as a courtesy in part because there's proximity, and I think there's a willingness to be reasonable in making architectural changes to appease an adjacent neighborhood.
Okay, very good. City Attorney, I have a question for you. Can the City Council compel the appellant to go work out an agreement with his neighbor? Because I think I agree with staff with the discussion about the safety issue and the extra wide driveway. I'm just curious if that's in fact something legally that can be done.
Yeah. The City Council has no power to compel two parties to reach an agreement regarding a private piece of property. Your power lies in balancing the safety and liability concerns expressed by staff with the development and with the options that exist to the applicant. By denying the project, you're not depriving the applicant from reasonable and commercial use of the property. There are other options that are available for development on that piece.
Okay.
But you cannot force them to enter into a private agreement between two sides.
Very good. Thank you. So those are all the questions that I have for staff at this time. This is a public hearing. I think what we typically do when there is an appeal, we give the appellant an opportunity to make their presentation, and then we will allow the rest of the community to come forward. Mr. Bischoff, are you the appellant, or are you representing the appellant tonight? Okay, why don't you come forward? I'm going to open this up to public comment. Donna, let's start with 5 minutes, and we'll see where we are after that.
Good evening, Mayor and Council members. My name is Paul Bischoff. I live in Grover Beach. I've lived here for about 22 years. First off, a couple of points. The architecture, definitely, I don't think that's really an issue. We're totally willing to change Unit 3 to match Berry Gardens, and I think the different issue, Mr. Mayor, is that we are taking access potentially from Arroyo Grande Street, so that kind of changes a little bit. They can dictate a tiny bit because of that. Otherwise, I think we would be right in
okay.
declining their request. There's another 5-foot pedestrian easement on the side too, but that's another issue. Another clarification: the HOA. I did approach that neighboring HOA, and there was no interest at all in sharing a driveway with us, and you know, being accommodating and that kind of thing. So, I think that is a non-starter. It was, but when I spoke to him before, and I'm sure it still is, or very confident that it is. So the driveway is the issue with what it has. So another kind of a philosophical point, it really feels like, regardless of what happens tonight to this project, the block on Oak Park going south between Long Branch and Manhattan, just north of this project, you can see it on the map that the condos bump out a little too far. The curb and gutter to the north and the curb and gutter to the south line up with each other, and that one block, the one in the upper left of the picture that you can see, actually sticks out probably 7 or 8 feet farther than the line that the other curb and gutters line up with. And there's actually legal parking on that block. So that's the spot that the lanes go from 2 to 1, and then past that block, it goes back to 2. So it feels like to me, aside from this issue, is that, you know, and again, easier for me to say because I don't live there, but there's 10 or so parking spaces on the street that probably need to go so that Oak Park has 2 lanes consistently all the way down. That certainly feels like the right way to do it, and it is a bummer that those 10 parking spaces for those residents would have to go away because of it. But then also, that would make the weirdness go away. There wouldn't be any transitioning from 2 to 1 back to 2, and then a lot of what we're talking about, I know the driveway compatibility is a big part of it, but being able to turn left and having to stop and having another lane to be able to stop and that kind of thing would vanish if that was the case. So the example, and I keep coming back to it, I admit, I tell people I fancy myself as an amateur psychologist. I completely admit that I might have a blind spot in this regard, but it feels like I don't, because it really, the Chevron station at 13th and Grand, I keep going back to, and the fact that it was built 7 or 8 years ago, and it has a 90-foot driveway approach, and there's been no collisions, there's been no pedestrian issues, there's people that are going in and out of that driveway all day long that are unfamiliar with the setup. So it feels wrong to me that there are restrictions from this project when we consider that the people that will be going in and out of this driveway will be familiar with the setup, they'll understand what's going on, they'll have experience in doing it because they live there. It'll be very, very few people who are visitors who will be going in and out of this driveway. When we have an example that was just built a few years ago, 7 or 8 years of experience with no collisions, no issues, people unfamiliar with the setup, out-of-towners, and there's no issue. So it just kind of strikes me as unfair that in that staff report, I actually dug up the staff report, there was no discussion about the width of the driveway. It was the same. The city had the same standard at the time. So it wasn't that it was allowed at the time and then now it's a more restrictive standard or something's changed. It was the standard at the time. And so that just kind of strikes at the heart of what I feel like I'm not getting why this is a problem and Chevron wasn't a problem. And again, the picture with all the colored lines going in and out, I think if we're not going to change the lanes and reduce the parking or eliminate the parking and make it two lanes in both directions, having a no left turn sign and not allowing left turns either in or out of this this project. And I would say, again, regardless of what happens here, and not having no left turns into the Brambles next door and not allowing them to turn left out onto Oak Park certainly seems like the right thing to do, regardless of what happens here. So the other point is that I think that I think it was Councilmember Shaw asked about the alternatives. It was just a little bit. The main issue was the front house, and if we essentially just flip the whole project to where the driveway was up against the apartments on the north, and the former owner has a 5-foot access easement that he essentially, he stole from himself because he owned the property at the time, to make his driveway work for the Brambles. So that's what we're up against. We don't have the width of the lot to where we can have a proper 5-foot setback for the home that's at the front. And so there'd be a bedroom window that didn't have a 5-foot yard. It would be right up against a driveway, and that just kind of feels like it would be a really real detriment to whoever would buy that house. And you know, I wouldn't want my kid sleeping down there with, you know, the driveway just right there on there. So I think that's one of the main reasons why the alternatives won't work, to where that would be an easy solution if it did, and we certainly wouldn't be here tonight if that was the case. So I think that was all I had to talk about.
Okay. So why don't you hang there? Let's see if there's any other questions for you, Mr. Bischoff.
Okay. Sounds good.
Councilmember Shaw, I think you answered the one question. Did you have any more?
The one other question I had was a traffic study was brought up. If a traffic study, would you be interested in funding a traffic study to see if the driveways would be problematic?
Right. I guess I'd have to see what we're trying to accomplish. It feels like the answer would be no, but yeah, I don't know if it's just purely, yeah, we'll approve it as it stands if the, yeah, that's kind of, I'm sorry, that's a little bit of an open-ended question, because then what requirements would the traffic study have to, the conclusions that they would have to reach, would we agree ahead of time is, oh, if the traffic study reached this conclusion, then we would approve your project, and if it fell short of this line, that feels nebulous to me, and so I'm not sure exactly how to answer that.
Okay. Councilmember Wright, do you have any questions of Mr. Bischoff?
No, not this time.
Councilmember Nichols?
Thank you.
Mayor Pro Tem Lee.
Thanks for clarifying a couple of items for me, because you did answer all of my questions except for one, and that has to do with the 5-foot easement, so that the parcel to the south basically granted themselves on the north. So was, and perhaps this is more a question for staff, and I don't know if there was any research that was done as to when that parcel map came forward, was there any discussion as to allowing or having something to provide for mutual access between the two properties at that point?
Yeah, as a complete aside, the architect who did the design for Berry Gardens mentioned at the other meeting that he was disappointed that he didn't see that and have it be stipulated that it wasn't just an exclusive easement, but that we could also use that their driveway as well, because it would have made sense to do that at the time.
Okay.
But I don't know about staff deciding at the time.
I can.
Is that outside? Yeah. You might want to have one of these men in a uniform check out there, Ms. McMahon. She goes charging. She goes charging out. We good? You sure, Chief? You should go put eyes on the site to make sure. Okay.
Councilmember Lee, I can confirm that S&S Homes was the original developer of the Berry Gardens project, and they did own this parcel as well. And it couldn't be integrated into the Berry Gardens project because this parcel happened to be in Grover Beach, not Arroyo Grande, where they were seeking their entitlement. So it was always seen as a remainder piece. But I do believe the original intent was that there would be two additional PUD units on the other side. That was the plan of the original developer. We're obviously here tonight because that does not apply in the city of Grover Beach.
Okay. I think that's all I've...
Sorry, I'm making funny faces because I'm sitting here. You said the owner of the land gave themselves an easement.
They did not.
I was going to say, you can't... Exactly. Okay.
So, again, if they would have went ahead and developed this piece of property in the city of Grover Beach with two additional patio homes, then they would have been able to have access ultimately to those two units through the shared driveway.
Okay. Okay. I don't have any questions of you. I think all the questions I have for you, Mr. Bischoff, have been asked and answered.
Okay.
So, but don't go far.
Okay. Yes, sir. Thanks.
Okay. So this is a public hearing. It's up to the public, and I do have one speaker request form, Mr. LeFerrier.
Good evening, Mayor and members of the City Council. I'll be real brief. I'm mainly here just as a courtesy to make myself available to any questions for a standard for an appealed project. I didn't want you to also lose sight of the I want to represent the process, and part of that process was sort of incomplete because we weren't really able to address the third unit, the east unit on Cranberry, with design modifications. There was no real way to make conditions of approval and then to recommend denial based on the safety issue. So if the council can get past the safety issue, the Planning Commission may be able to assist if it was only design issues. If it had only been design issues, I would like to think we would have solved that there, but we didn't really have that option, and the applicant wanted to have his project heard as he has the right to do so. So there may be an option if you do get past the safety issue, however, that the Planning Commission could take on that testimony and work with the applicant and staff if that's something that you didn't want to do. Consider us an option if you can make that happen with the process. But I just want to make myself available, and if you have any questions now, go ahead. If not, I can just observe from back there.
Yeah, John, and thank you for being here. I really appreciate that. So does anyone have any questions of Mr. LeFerrier? Because I think that's a very good clarification, and it really helps me a lot. Anyone else?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Is there anyone else that would like to address the item before the council? Okay, seeing no one come forward, I'm going to close the public comment on this item. I do have a question of staff, and I want to be very careful about how I ask this question. Mr. Bischoff pointed out the driveway on the corner of 13th and Grand. And I know that over the years that project has been seen to be successful, but I don't believe that came to the council. That was a Planning Commission approval, correct?
That is correct. As I recall, that project was never before you. A couple of things, Honorable Mayor, Council Members. First of all, I think that without getting into too many details, that you're dealing with completely two separate factual scenarios. Grand is a different type of street, is aligned differently. There are not as many of the conflicting issues that were identified on this particular street. But even for a minute, if we assume that these two situations were identical and that staff blew it, they missed it or they didn't bring it to the Planning Commission's attention, and that item was not discussed and approval was given in spite of the issue. That wasn't the case, but let's just assume for a moment that it was. That doesn't make the issues go away on this project. In other words, the old saying, if we've done it wrong before, doesn't mean we have to do it wrong again. So if you cannot make the safety findings in this particular project, the fact that another project was approved that may or may not have had similar issues does not bind you to that approval. So my recommendation to you, legally speaking, is you look at this project as the project, the situation that was explained by staff, the safety concerns, and you deal with those on this, on these bases. Trying to compare it to another project, whether or not it was done accurately, correctly, or whether it had different circumstances that led to the findings and the approvals that were pertinent to that project is really not germane or relevant to your review of this particular issue and need to making the findings on this particular issue.
So do we know if there was any exceptions allowed in the case of that project?
We believe that there was an exception, but the process and how the Planning Commission came to the determination that that was acceptable, we're not aware of.
Okay, and I have a specific reason for asking that question, because when you said our standard is a 24-foot wide driveway, that seems, I know that's pretty standard for, let's say, a two-car garage, but has there ever been a situation where a smaller or narrow driveway has been proposed or approved?
So our standards for residential is a 10-foot wide minimum.
Okay.
And a 24 maximum. Okay. Commercial, I don't remember the minimum, but the maximum is 35, I believe. It's in that range.
Okay.
And then the Chevron driveway was approved as part of their development permit application. Our city standards allow deviations from city standards if the director can find it's safe and serves the same purpose, you know, that type of thing.
So okay.
In that case, they found that driveway design was safe.
Great. So, staff, can you put alternative B on the screen or exhibit EII? I'm not sure how you've labeled this. Now I have to put my glasses on. Yes, that is the one. Can you walk us through that? Because I think Mr. Bischoff talked about a 5-foot. I saw the 5 feet along the existing drive, but what's on the north side?
So this lot is 53.5 feet wide, and that includes this 5-foot easement that's part of the lot but cannot be developed with structure because it allows for ingress and egress, vehicular and pedestrian. So that leaves you with really a 48.5-foot wide lot. And I guess staff would just like to interject that there's a discussion of the 5-foot easement is unique. It is. But you still have a 48.5-foot wide lot. Most lots in this city, as you know, are 50 feet, and we see plan unit developments developed on 50-foot wide lots everywhere. That's the standard. So you have 1.5 feet less in this lot. So staff really believes that there are all sorts of alternative designs here that can still accommodate a decent size, two single-family detached homes, as the applicant is desiring to do here, by flipping the driveway over on this side. We'd also point out that Unit 1 here in the front and Unit 2 that's accessed off of Oak Park Boulevard have the same exact footprint. Well, it may be that this unit should have an altered footprint that would allow it to be accommodated within that 48.5 feet. So we believe strongly that there are design alternatives that would make this alignment work with the driveway to the north.
Okay. So, and what are you showing with the driveway on the north? What's the width? The width of the drive
The typical fire lane is 18 feet that's required. So this driveway is shown as 18 feet. But as you see here, the garage needs usually 24 feet of backup to the fence line. But the home only needs an 18-foot separation to have enough fire lane. So this house right here could be expanded out an additional 6 feet. So when we, again, talk about redesign of the unit, there are ways of adding more square footage with the driveway to the north.
Okay, because I'm just curious, because I think Mr. Bischoff made the point of, if you put the homes like this, then you've got a rear yard that basically abuts a 5-foot easement that allows for pedestrian
correct
access.
And I don't think, quite honestly, staff would see that as an ideal situation either. Whether, again, if you're back to a 48.5 net lot, you can still have 5 feet back here. That means a foot and a half might have to come out of the home. Or in this case, the garage is actually 23 and a half feet deep. It only needs to be 21. So okay, the garage depth can be reduced on this unit. So we're just suggesting that there are alternatives that have not been looked at to create a project that perhaps can still be feasible and meet the applicant's desires as well.
Okay. That conversation stimulate any questions from anyone?
I had a question.
Okay, Councilmember Shaw.
I drove by this today, and to my eye, it just doesn't seem like that big of a deal, but I know I don't have the trained eye. I guess that's why I'm just going back to the traffic study. If we could get a traffic study that would, because one thing that really stood out in the report to me, and the reason that I appreciate you guys really making us adhere to the standards, is because this is such a complicated area and something that has been so thought out that if, heaven forbid, there is an accident, the city is going to be on the hook. And that is one reason I think we do need to be sticklers and make sure, we dot our I's and cross our T's. But would there be, I'm just wondering, how much would a traffic study cost? Would it be something we could do? Because it sounds like we need to fix up some of these lanes anyway, and the bike lane and the parking situation.
Who brought up the issue of traffic studies? This
we were, staff doing what we're supposed to do, and that is attempt to help the applicant have a successful project. So we looked at the three alternatives that we showed you, showed the Planning Commission that you've seen here tonight, and then we looked at what additional information do we think we would need to make any of these? Now, with the alternative that we can stand behind, which is the driveway to the north edge of the property, even with that, we think that there's opportunities, perhaps through a traffic study, to improve this intersection, perhaps actually, because this is far enough up, this driveway is far enough up that it would actually face the center median. And so essentially there would only be right turns out and right turns into this property, unless the center median were modified. And so a traffic study would be needed to determine the appropriate way to modify that center median if, in fact, it was desired to have left turns out and left turns in to this proposed driveway or this driveway option. Then, thinking that, okay, if a traffic study could potentially resolve that problem, is it possible that a traffic study could resolve the problem of having two driveways separated only by the 2-foot city standard? Again, rather than staff reaching beyond the edge of our practiced expertise, we felt it was appropriate to recommend a traffic study to consider that.
Okay, but when did you recommend this traffic study? At the start of this process or before it came? I'm just struggling with this because I thought, did you suggest that at the start of this process or in the middle of this process? I get a huge issue with a traffic study, imposing it on a property owner when you're telling me it's a larger issue on Oak Park. I mean, so that's my concern with imposing a traffic study on something that is developing less dense than what is allowed. And I'm trying to
Mayor, if I could
that.
So to be clear, the traffic study was not suggested to resolve existing problems on Oak Park Boulevard. So as an example,
I understand
if this, it's not up there, but if the northerly driveway option were considered, staff could be supportive of it as is.
Okay.
Simply do it, and we're supportive. Because left turns would be prohibited. They're just simply wouldn't exist, and so there it is. If the applicant chose to go to the additional step with that driveway location, then there would clearly have to be modifications made to the roadway at the applicant's request. Really, the same thing exists with the 2-foot driveway separation, only to a lesser degree. Again, you don't really have a left turn into the property with the just 2-foot separation. It borderlines on not having left turn access, and it's close enough that, again, if the applicant desired that, it would be appropriate to have the applicant address how to modify the road to allow left turns, not to correct any other perceived issues with Oak Park in this vicinity.
Okay. Can you go back to the other alternative? The one with the access there. Thank you. So, Mr. Ray, you're saying if the applicant was willing to do this or some modified version that's close to this, so maybe it's not 18 feet, it's 18 feet and you pull the house closer, you're saying that staff could support something like this because this addresses the safety issues that were identified and the commission felt they could not make the finding.
Yes, this is the option developed by staff and supported by staff, and the only option supported by staff.
Okay. Do you have? I don't want to dominate the conversation, but I'm trying to help us get to a point where we can either form a recommendation or a motion one way or the other.
Yeah, and I'm actually struggling with I think similar concepts that other members of the council are, in the fact that it appears, whatever the appropriate term is that we have an issue on South Oak Park in this area that would exist with or without this property. And I'm wondering what the long-term circulation improvements, or if nothing ever happened on this property, would there be any improvements that would be necessary in this area, such as what Mr. Bischoff said with regards to the development to the west is out a little bit further. Is there a plan to put two lanes in both directions through here, possibly with a left turn lane, or is there a long-term plan for this area with or without this property?
So you'd have to look to the circulation element,
right, exactly.
Which does suggest two lanes in either direction, and then you really, to resolve the issue, I believe we would really be looking to an existing development just to the north of this one, if I can see it correctly there. Oh, sorry, just out of the picture. But we'd be looking to an existing development that's just out of the picture, where if that property redevelops, roadway realignment could be conditioned, and then a lot of these issues could be resolved. So, to some extent, there is a long-range plan. Is it possible right now to enact that plan? No.
Okay.
There simply isn't enough right-of-way width at the current time to create two lanes in each direction, a center turn lane, and even with or without the parking, you're running short on right-of-way space there. So.
Okay.
I guess where I'm struggling with is there's alternatives, but expressed in as Mr. Bischoff said, this is the design, this is the project that he wants. So I'm struggling trying to offer an opportunity to, or thinking of trying to fashion an opportunity to send this back through staff and possibly through the Planning Commission to develop an alternative. But I don't know if there's a acceptable alternative to the developer, and Mr. Bischoff.
Well, I was going to suggest that I bring him back up. City Attorney.
Thank you. Honorable Mayor and Council Members, in answer to Mayor Pertem's inquiry, again, I think the process is that you do take action on this appeal, on the project as it's before you. That preserves the applicant's rights to do whatever he wishes to do after that. And you send a recommendation back down if it's the desire, obviously, of the council, that another alternative is explored and brought back before the Planning Commission, if the applicant is willing to obviously consider it. That would involve the supported alternative, I'll call it, that's the one that staff supports, and some revisions to the size or footprint of the house that would account for the 5-foot setback on the south side of the property. With that, the staff can continue the conversation and the Planning Commission can look at the project again with all the other issues that are involved. That is an option that exists, but again, that's a decision that a majority of you need to decide on.
So a clarification, if the council upholds the Planning Commission's action, which in effect is a denial of this project, would the applicant have to wait a certain amount of time before he could refile?
I think that if that denial is with a recommendation and instruction to staff to continue the conversation, if the applicant wishes to do that and basically bring a revised project back to the Planning Commission, I don't think that the applicant at this point in time would need to wait to refile, because it would obviously have to be a different project that would come back. For example, if you just did a denial, nothing would stop him from tomorrow filing an application with a revised footprint that would reflect what we're discussing.
I got you. So it would have to be a substantially different project.
Flipping the exactly. It would have to go along with the again, the recommended alternative. And if that is the desire, again, I'm not trying to put direction or a decision into your process. But if the council upholds the Planning Commission denial and the basis for it, you do have an option of sending the project back with direction or recommendation that the discussion of the preferred or recommended alternative be continued, and that the applicant can work with staff and bring the project back in front of the Planning Commission with those parameters if he desires to do that. It still preserves his rights for the finality of the action on this project. It doesn't require him to refile and pay alternate fees and restart basically the process. And I'll defer to the director as far as any changes or comments to the proposed solution to this, but I think that would be something that would be within your power should you desire to do so.
So let me do this. I want to open this back up to the public and ask Mr. Bishop to come forward. You want to ask your question? Or did you not have a question?
Actually, I had a question for the city engineer.
Well, then I'll ask the question. So you've seen, and I know you had originally talked about that your concerns with the one alternative B, but you heard staff's comments. I mean, are you open? I know you were talking about you're open to changing the architecture to be more compatible with Berry Gardens because you're having to take access on is it Cranberry? Mm-hmm. So based on staff's comments, are you open to modifying the floor plan or finding a way to move it forward to give you an actual rear yard that gives you that clearly promotes some safety and a comfort for someone purchasing this home?
Right. Yeah, I think I am generally. The owner, actually, Mr. O'Sullivan, has, when we were talking about alternatives, he was thinking maybe the right solution is just to reload completely and do apartments and have a little bit of density bonus because of affordable units. And that's, I know that the neighbors don't want that. They don't want, I think with the state law, we could do 8 units with density bonuses and that kind of thing. So that's a different issue altogether. But at the same time, I'll definitely run it by him. I think tonight, though, just from my knowledge of what I know, what he wants, let's vote on this. And then if he wants to reload with the driveway on the other side, then so be it. But I would offer, hopefully, that I totally appreciate your thoughts about delineating issues that are already there, regardless of our project, and then solutions. Because it did feel like going down the road, it was there are problems with this project because see our lanes collapse and see there's no parking over here and stuff that was outside our control. Mm-hmm. So I do appreciate you at least opening that idea up.
Very good. Thank you.
Okay. So good. Thanks.
Yeah, very good. Yeah. John, did you have anything else you want to add? Okay, I'm going to close it and bring it back. And Miriam, Councilman Shaw, I like the idea of maybe a traffic study or looking at it, but I think really my concern is requiring a property owner to do something that seems to be a bigger issue. And I think as we move south, we do need to take a look at that. Is there a way to improve that situation for everyone? Because I can tell you I shop at Vaughn's often, and I completely understand what you're talking about, the merging of lanes and trying to make a left turn, but the other truth of the matter is we cannot deny access to this property, so we have to make sure that it's safe. Anyway, okay, I think we've had a lot of discussion. You've heard what Mr. Bischoff said. Does someone prepare to make a motion on this item? Or some discussion?
Maybe I'll ask a question of discussion first.
Okay.
And going back to the project as designed. So, and I don't mean to open up an additional can of worms if that's what I'm about to do. But realizing that Mr. Bischoff has not had any success with the landowner to the south, if he was able to have that ability to combine that driveway into one single driveway, would that be supportable by staff?
Yeah, basically, if you're retaining it's an existing 23-foot wide driveway, if you were to share that driveway, we feel that's the best scenario with one shared driveway.
Okay.
We would also point out that in that scenario, we don't know what the negotiation was between the applicant, but it would also, if you did have one shared driveway, you would then have more square footage to develop on this site. So there is added benefit in having larger units as a result of not having to provide a driveway on this particular parcel.
Okay. So realizing that's not the option in front of us this evening, I just wanted to make sure that was clear that would be a supportable option, either the driveway to the north or combining of the driveways to the south. Okay.
I just want to be clear as far as I think what staff was discussing was using the existing driveway as a shared driveway, not combining additional width into it.
And that's how I understood that.
Right.
Correct.
Okay. Karen, did you have anything? Or are you?
I have a little discussion if we want to do that. But
sure, let's have some discussion.
Okay. I appreciate everybody being here and all the information that's come forward because it is very helpful to me, being that we didn't hear the whole issue from the get-go. I, though, am still concerned about the safety situation of that, the way that the traffic pattern goes. And I understand Mr. Bischoff's concern about the chevron width of that driveway. I, though, have seen a lot of issues whenever I use that station and it's crowded. I don't know who's going where. It really is concerning. And then you've got people walking their dogs and their kids, and it, to me, is... seems like it's an accident waiting to happen. So for that issue, I believe these issues can be worked out, and I'd like to see this project come to fruition. But the way that it is at this point in time, I could not support it based on those reasons.
Good comments. Councilmember Nichols?
I have gotten very off track, I think, in... the existing driveway, it appears to loop around and go between the rows of houses. Is that what I'm seeing?
That is correct. The driveway for these,
right.
I forgot, 20 units or so,
right,
loops all the way down to here. They're all garage accessed off the rear.
So the automobile access to units 1 and 2 would just loop into a garage off that same driveway if it were a shared driveway?
Yes, they would come in here and they would turn into driveways
okay.
oriented this way.
Okay.
Okay. Councilor Michelle?
That makes a big
Whoops.
Difference in how I'm looking at the project.
Okay. Sorry.
It's okay.
You done?
I'm done.
Okay. Excellent. Councilor Michelle.
I appreciate everyone's comments, and I just hope that you, Mr. Bischoff, stick with us, because I hope you get the feeling we do want to get this done. I think everybody does. So I also just want to point out a small thing we talked about earlier, because I know we got this letter from Arroyo Grande at the last second, and we were all looking through it. But Kelly Heffernan actually did not, she requested that we look at these, and it was just that the Berry Gardens laws say shall. She was misquoted. So I just wanted to point that out.
There's an official city letter in the packet that I was referring to.
Yes.
From.
Yeah, I agree with you, John. In the
A different one in the packet.
Previous,
I thought you were talking about
packet.
This one. No. This one was
no.
a request. Right.
That was a request.
Okay.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I guess there's really no way to just put these two driveways next to each other and let them act as one. So other than that, I guess I'd be ready to make a motion that unfortunately we would adopt the resolution denying.
Okay. Why don't you hold that thought? Let's see what Mayor Pro Tem Lee has to say.
Actually, I was going to kind of second along that same line in the fact that given the project in front of us, while I would prefer to allow Mr. Bischoff and Mr. O'Sullivan to go work out a solution, it sounds like they've gone down that path and a solution is not forthcoming. So based upon the safety issues, the incompatibility of Unit 3 is surmountable. I think it's the safety issue with the driveway. I would be supportive of a denial without prejudice. I don't know if that's the appropriate term, so that if he did, if the applicant did have an opportunity to fashion a solution with the neighbors to the south, that he would not have to, that wouldn't be a substantially different project, so he could come forward with that, if that is not a substantially different project.
Okay, just so staff is clear on this issue. So, and if it's accepted by the maker of the motion, so the motion would be that is to deny the project based on the safety concerns and to uphold the denial of the Planning Commission. And the denial would be without prejudice with regard to a project that would involve a joint driveway. So in other words, if the applicant came back and said, I've worked it out and I can use the one driveway that exists as a joint driveway for the project, that would basically be sufficiently enough substantial change to bring the project back. Is that what's being contemplated by the second?
Potentially, but I don't know if we would we need to limit it to that?
Well, and that's where I'm going with this, because denial without prejudice means that he basically can bring the same project back within a year rather than not bring it back. So if it's the intention of the council or the maker of the motion or the seconder to provide that Mr. Bischoff can revise the project consistent with the discussions here and continue the discussion with staff if he desires to do so, if Mr. Sullivan desires to do so, then basically it would be a denial with a direction to staff rather than without prejudice to basically follow the discussion that was here. And if the applicant is willing to flip the project or decrease the footprint or use one driveway, find a way to use the driveway to continue the process.
Okay, so.
And I'll make that a motion.
Well, I was going to go to the alleged maker of the motion because I wasn't. Okay. So Miriam, what was your intent with your motion that I asked you to hold a thought on?
Good question. I guess my intent with the motion was to adopt the present resolution denying the appeal and upholding the Planning Commission's action in such a manner that it is without prejudice.
Okay.
And without prejudice is opposite to what I just said.
Oh, no. Okay, then.
Okay.
We
I just want to make sure we're speaking.
So how about we do? So yeah. How about someone try and fasten a motion, because I'm sensing there is a consensus up here to uphold the Planning Commission's decision. Because I'll just say that I didn't contribute my additional thoughts. I think two of the three findings can be made, and I think I'm where the commission is, and I think Mr. LeFerrier brought it up tonight. The safety issue remains at the heart of not being able to make all three findings. So I think, as you had talked about earlier, really the proper one course of action, maybe the most prudent way to do, is to uphold the Planning Commission's decision to deny the project and then give staff direction to continue working with the applicant and his representatives, and we would be looking for a change to the project. And really, I would think that would be a redesign of the project and having the driveway on the north side, because I can just say that in all the years I've dealt with these situations, whether it's with private companies or public agencies, trying to get someone to work with you on driveways and even trying to I don't think we really want to force that on anyone. And then we can't technically deny them access to this property. So it sounds like the only way to address this safety issue that is not difficult is to flip it, put the driveway on the north side. But basically the motion is to uphold the Planning Commission's decision to deny this project as designed, but then give just direction to staff to continue working with the applicant and his agent to modify the project with the driveway on the north side that minimizes or eliminates the safety concerns.
Yes, that is my motion.
Sorry.
That's exactly what I meant.
Is there a second?
I'll go ahead and second that.
Okay. I think we've had a lot of discussion on this one, and it's item number one. Anyway, let's do a roll call.
Yes.
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 Yes. Okay. Thank you, everyone. I know it's was a complicated issue, and I think we all want to try and do the fair thing, and sometimes it just is difficult to get there. Anyway, let's move on. I think the second item should be a lot quicker. Item number two. And Jeff, did you tell your sister how long these meetings go?
I did give her a heads up.
She didn't ride with me.
She did not.
Excellent. All right. Item number two is a time extension for a tentative track map located at 204 through 280 West Grand Avenue. Community Director Buckingham.
Good evening, Mayor and members of the council. The Beach Place mixed-use project located on the south side of West Grand Avenue between 2nd and 3rd Streets was approved by the Planning Commission in January of 2000. The project's approximately 33,000 square feet and consists of 7 commercial units and 15 residential units, which is a correction from your staff report. After the project was constructed in the early 2000s, the applicant applied for a tentative tract map to subdivide the commercial and residential units into 22 airspace condominiums for the purpose of being able to then sell them individually as legal units. In December 2006, the City Council approved that tentative tract map. The tract map approval required a recordation of the final map within 2 years, consistent with the state's Subdivision Map Act at the time in 2006. However, as a result of the recession, the state legislature made 4 different amendments to the MAP Act, which allowed 7 additional years to the life of that tentative tract map. So as a result of the 2-year approval and the 7 years of extensions granted by the state legislature, this map has been extended 9 years until December of 2015. The final map has not been recorded, therefore the applicant is requesting a 1-year time extension to allow additional time to receive approval from the California Bureau of Real Estate, formerly known as the DRE, related to the processing of the condo map and the associated documents, of the public reports and so forth. Staff does not review and approve the condo map. It's actually done by the Department of Real Estate. The MAP Act also indicates the city may add additional conditions of approval to a time extension order for the final map to conform with existing city standards. Staff did review the development code and determined that no new conditions are required at this time. So in conclusion, staff is recommending the council adopt the resolution approving a one-year time extension for this tentative track map.
Very good. Thank you for the staff report. Any questions of staff?
I had just Michelle? One quick question. In your report, it said it will be deferring the documents and fees. I just wondered how much are the fees that will be deferred for a year?
Can you indicate where that's...
In the discussion section, paragraph 2, line 3. It's just the applicant has not submitted the required documents and fees.
Yes, so there are everything from filing fees that are required for the county recorder to the property taxes are reassessed and they have to provide a property tax bond. So those are the fees. They're not necessarily city fees.
Okay.
They're fees associated with the recording.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Okay. Councilor Bright.
I don't see a downside to approving this extension. Is there one?
No, not in staff's opinion.
Thank you.
Very good. Mayor Pro Tem Lee.
Just one question is, am I reading this correctly, there would be two more one-year extensions possible?
Correct. So okay. The MAP Act has always stated that after the initial two-year approval, you are eligible for 3 one-year time extensions. So this request is only the first of those three possible.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay. Councilmember Nichols.
I just find it kind of unreasonable that after a 9-year delay, he still needs more time to receive approval from the California Bureau of Real Estate regarding this whole issue.
Well, unfortunately, Mr. Kepp, the applicant, is not here tonight. But in prior conversations, I mean, I think first and foremost, the delay has just been the recession. In order to sell the units, which is the primary purpose of having a condominium market or condominium map, you need a strong market. So there was obviously just a long holding period, though I think he's at times been very serious about moving forward with completing that process. You know, now he is serious, but he just needs additional time to complete it.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Bruce. Has there been any significant changes to the city's general plan, zoning ordinance, development codes, and any other ordinances that might affect this project?
No, there have not. We did review that. I mean, we do have a new development code,
okay.
But in this case, you have an approved project. This is just airspace units of an existing building, so there were no revisions that were
Very
necessary.
Good. And the reason I ask that is when we get into these sort of things where people are asking for extensions of time, I want to make sure that we're very thorough, because what often can happen is people just summarily grant an approval and we missed that there was a change in the codes that we should have applied. So that's why I'm asking that.
Correct. And this is not a vesting map, so changes would be applicable, as well as he has to pay all current fees today. He's not locked in because of a vesting map.
Okay, very good. Thank you. With that, I'm going to open this up to the public. Is there anyone from the community that would like to address the item before the council? Seeing no one come forward, I'm going to close it. And who on the council is prepared to make a motion on this item?
I will.
Okay.
I'll make a motion that we adopt the resolution approving a one-year time extension for the tentative track map.
I'll second that.
Okay, there's a motion and a second. Is there any discussion on the motion? Okay, seeing none, roll call.
Yes.
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 Yes, thank you, Donna. Motion carries. So let's move on to our consent agenda. The consent agenda is basically where we consider items as a group, and we looks like we have 5 items on the consent agenda tonight. One is the Treasury report for the period of October 14th through the 28th. One is the Treasury report for the Streets Bond Act, Measure K-14, and that's for the same period of time as number 3. The second, another one is the second reading and adoption of ordinance number 15-05, amending the Grover Beach Municipal Code, Article 10, Chapter 4, changing the wagering limits to a no-limit game. We have an award of design services for the Community Development Block Grant-funded water main project. And then finally, there is a proposed 3-year successor memorandum of understanding with Service Employees International Union, Local 620. Do any members of the council want to pull any items from the consent agenda?
No.
None to my left?
I had a couple questions on item 6, but I don't know if we need to pull it.
So why don't you ask your questions, and then we'll determine based on the responses we get if we want to pull it.
Okay. Okay. Actually, they're all for the city engineer, and I apologize that I did not ask these questions in advance of the meeting, but I know you'll be able to answer them. Actually, one of them may need the community development director because it's an environmental question. So, but my first question is, there was five groups in the report mentioned that there was five groups that were that proposed. Wallace is the successful bidder or the successful proponent, and in this staff report, who were the other four that came forward? Do you recall?
I recall a few of them. Cannon, company called Monsoon, a couple of companies that we actually haven't worked with before. GTA did not propose,
okay.
If you're curious. Stantec, yeah, who's working with us right now on the existing street design. So, and there were two others. And,
okay.
I don't recall them.
So kind of a different mix on this one than other proposals, RFPs we've had out on the streets.
Yes.
So some familiar, some different. So.
Some familiar, some new firms. I think I would say that actually a lot of the proposals were compelling. I mean, they didn't necessarily score the highest, but there were some compelling proposals.
Okay, gotcha. Next question has to do with the alternate bid items. It looks like there's on the map you're proposing or identifying two areas of alternate bids. And are those included in the design contract?
Yes. So the design would design those sections, but in the construction bid would identify them as alternates. And the reason for doing that is simply to attempt to use all the funds, but not overrun the existing funds. So it gives staff flexibility simply to award the maximum amount of the project based on bids.
Okay, great. And then I noticed there was an alternate item or an optional staking item in the contract, but that wasn't included in the proposal coming forward. I was wondering why.
Well, so it's a construction staking item, and the staff is anticipating having the construction staking provided by the contractor.
By the contractor, okay, very good. And then the last question has to do with environmental with regards to CEQA and NEPA, and just wondering where that stands for these for this project, or do we anticipate that being a separate action coming forward?
That's a good question. The project should be categorically exempt because it's replacement of an existing water line within the existing right-of-way. So it doesn't need to come forward. It would be a categorical.
So if we're going to have more discussion, we should probably take this item off. But
that's all I had.
Is that all you had?
Yeah.
Okay. I thought you were going.
Nope.
You had more? Okay. So does anyone, I guess based on the questions and the responses, does anyone feel compelled to pull this item from consent, or are you comfortable leaving this on consent agenda?
Okay.
Yeah, sounds good. All right.
I did have a question on item number 7.
Okay.
As well, and it's mostly the fact that we have a new document on the dais with us.
Okay.
And I'm wondering if someone could just give us a brief update as to what the changes are.
There were some very minor typographical errors, and for instance, I believe the first one was a date that was inappropriately identified. Effective dates were revised from 2016 to 2017 and 2016 to July 1st, 2017. And there was the one-time added lump sum payment of $400. That was added, that's the retroactive pay.
Okay, and you had discussed that in the staff report, it just was
not
in.
Right.
Okay. Okay.
And the representatives of the SEIU have seen this in our.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, anyone, do you guys comfortable leaving this on consent, or do you want to pull this item for full discussion?
I'm all right with it.
Okay.
I'm okay.
I think at this, we're good? Okay. So someone prepared to make a motion on the consent agenda?
I move we accept the consent agenda as presented.
I'll second with the request that we do not as presented but as modified.
as modified with the SEIU.
Okay, so the maker of the motion is comfortable with that amendment.
Yes.
Second, are you good with that?
Do we need to take public?
I believe I had opened this up to the public. I didn't want to. I think the next step would have been to pull them off and have a full staff report and a full discussion. Yeah. So I think we're all comfortable. So at this point, we can do this with a roll call vote. Correct, City Attorney?
That's correct.
Yeah. Okay. Donna, roll call, please.
Yes.
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 Yes. The motion carries. So let's move on to our regular business. And this is item number 8. This is a status report on the police department staffing, establishing a job classification and salary range for police officer trainee, and adjusting the salary range for reserve police officer. Police Chief Peters, you have the floor.
Good evening, Honorable Mayor and members of the council. I come before you tonight to discuss the status report on the police department staffing, as well as establishing the job classification for a police officer trainee and increasing the salary range for the reserve officer position. The Grover Beach Police Department is a 24-hour patrol service-oriented police department that provides emergency officer, the police officers, as well as emergency dispatching for the law enforcement sector and the fire department, Five Cities Fire Authority, that is for the cities of Royal Granny, Grover Beach, and the community of Oceano. Currently, the police department is staffed with 9 sworn positions. It's actually not staffed, it's authorized, 9 sworn positions, and 9 non-sworn or professional positions through the department. In your packets, you will have information in regards to some of the attachments that were included that will also discuss statistical data as we go forward. But the sworn officer breakdown is 1 chief, the 2 commanders, which currently the 2 commanders are being divided up amongst their duties. One is assisting in the patrolling and operations of the watch commander duties instead of actually doing their full position of operations commander. The other commander is completely dedicated to recruitment and hiring of the vacant positions that we currently have. We also have 4 sergeants allotted, but one position is vacant right now. We did recently make a conditional offer to a potential employee who is completing testing for that one vacancy, and hopefully that position will be filled later on this month. In addition, we have 4 senior police officers that have been approved, 6 police officers, and this is where we come to the heart of the issue, 3 vacancies currently in those roles. In addition to that, we have 2 positions that are currently tied up. One officer is in training and is not expected to be released off for solo patrol until probably around December, mid-December, and the other position is tied up due to a medical retirement that's not going to be in place until April. So that position is basically frozen until that time. So if you can think about it, that's 6 sworn positions that are not on the street of that 19 total. In addition to that, from the latest word that I have, we may be losing a full-time police officer to another agency near us by the end of the month. So that would create a 4th vacancy. The department also operates a 2 detective position, but currently those positions are vacant because of staffing. They had to be rotated back to patrol to adequately cover the patrol operations, which basically is our primary function. For the non-sworn positions, the breakdown goes with 6 dispatchers. There's currently 1 vacancy in one of those roles. However, we did make a job offer to someone here this month, and they are completing the rest of the testing process and hopefully will be in place sometime in December. The 1 dispatch supervisor position, currently the 1 records clerk position, and the 1 confidential administrative assistant, which assist the operations commander and the admin commander, as well as myself, with preparing reports and statistical data, and is also assist in the records position. Since we, back in 2009, we had the 2nd position that retired and was not filled. So to give you a little bit of a rundown on what the officers are handling in the field right now, there are 10 sworn officers that are out on patrol. During the whole 24 hours, 7 days a week. We've got the whole shift split up by 10 people. Those 10 people are averaging about 1,652 calls per month, which is about 165 calls per officer per month. Right now, we do not have any detectives, so the solvability of crimes is taking a little bit longer, mm-hmm. And obviously that impacts the time frame on those cases being cleared. Proactive policing is extremely difficult to do at this time because, as you can imagine, a shift that may have only two, at most three officers on it, and 165 calls are going to each officer each month, they're pretty busy going from call to call, report call to report call, and taking a lot of reports and information. This is some of the statistical data that is included in your packet. And as you will see that in reference to some law changes, Proposition 47, as well as some of the staffing issues that we had, we've had a statistical increase in criminal activity, and in particular narcotics and property crimes. The increases are significant in some areas, like an auto theft. That could be partially attributed probably to Santa Maria getting aggressive with their auto theft task force. They had over 700 auto thefts last year and had reduced those auto thefts so far this year to under 500 with a full-time team. And then in the beginning of this year, we saw 12 auto thefts in January that were pretty much associated around Honda-type vehicles that were common target for the Santa Maria auto thieves. But as a result, you'll notice in the bottom, there's a, with the staffing shortages, there's a decrease in traffic enforcement and a decrease in citations being issued, which I think there is a direct correlation in traffic collisions. If we're not educating the bad drivers and enforcing the traffic laws, unfortunately, those bad drivers do create collisions. So the police department has been conducting a pretty aggressive recruitment program so far with in conjunction with Chanel Hubbard, our human resources coordinator for the city. We've advertised statewide. We've advertised in local social media aspects. We've gone through the academies in the Central California area, not just in our area, but Hanford, Fresno, Tulare, Kings County, those areas, we've paid visits to them and gave presentations to their recruits. Just today, we actually entertained four of the Hanford Academy recruits for a testing process that they began today. With that, we had some issues that we wanted to bring up, and we thought about how can we get more competitive and more attractive to the recruits that are out there. Right now, we only hire from lateral police officers and academy graduate police officer positions. That has restricted our ability to attract potential qualified and good quality candidates when we do not offer to send them through the academy. So the creation of a police officer trainee program would be one step in getting that recruitment level up. Other agencies around us, for instance, Pismo Beach just went with this program. Santa Maria has had this program in place for a while, and other agencies are considering it. I talked to the chief of police in Pismo Beach, and he, in the first 2 weeks of their police officer trainee program, they had over 60 applications received. So there's interest out there. It's just a matter of, is it financially feasible for some people to make that leap and devote 6 months of training, or 5 to 6 months of training, while at the academy. The other option, or the other items that we were talking about tonight, are increasing the reserve officer's pay. Right now, our reserve officer pay is pretty low and below the average for the area. And other ideas that have been talked about amongst staff and city staff are either relocation or hiring incentives. Several agencies are doing this. Santa Maria does it. Fresno does it. And obviously, those are larger agencies, but this is actually on the minds of several police chiefs in this county as well. So I'll take you over to the reserve officer program and how it currently functions. Right now, we have three levels of reserve police officer. Level three is the basic officer who goes through what's called PCA 32, and they basically learn the laws of arrest and how to effect arrests. Those police officers are required to ride with a state-certified police officer who has a post certificate, and they have to be under the direct supervision of that full-time officer at all times. So a level 3 position right now we do not fill because it is not advantageous to us at this moment. The level 2 position is very similar to the level 3 position, except the person has gone through much more training, and they are able to, like, a jail transport on their own or do traffic control on their own. But they cannot patrol solely on their own. They have to patrol with another certified, state-certified officer, a full-time officer. And the level 1 position, which we currently do have one level 1 reserve officer on the department, those are officers that are approved for solo patrol after they've completed their massive training, over 664 hours plus about additional 700 hours within the department, in addition to all their annual training requirements that they must meet. Currently, the level 3 position starts at $8 an hour, and the level 1 position tops out at $16 an hour. If you take a look at the items that are in front of you, let's see, if it's the range is fairly low in comparison to the other agencies around us within this county. The average starting from the other agencies is $24.35 an hour, up to $38 an hour. So we're not very competitive in the reserve officer market. We've been advertising. We've been asking for over a year and a half, 2 years now for reserve officers, and haven't received any applications. So the proposed salary increase or new salary range that staff has come up with is a lot more competitive, and it allows us to start the level 3 reserve officer at $17 an hour, and then as they progress over several years, they will go to about $21 an hour. The level 2 officer would then start at $22 an hour, and after several years, they would go to top out of $26 an hour. And then the level 1 police officer would start at $27 per hour, and then after several years and many thousands of hours of service, they will go up to $31 an hour as long as they meet the standards of the organization. What this allows us to do is it gains compliance within the minimum wage standards, which are coming up. As you know, you may be aware that they're changing in January to go to $10 an hour. So even our current level 3 police officer will be below minimum wage. So this will get us in compliance with minimum wage standards, and this will also get us a little bit more attractive and recruiting police officers to come in. As the reserve officer program has worked, we usually hire a reserve officer, level 1. We train them, get them ready, and they jump into a role that becomes vacant, a full-time police officer role. So it's kind of our own internal recruitment ground where in total, the police officer training, which we'll discuss here in a moment, the police officer training would be our bottom starting officer position that would eventually go to maybe a reserve officer position or a full-time position depending on the vacancies. But then our reserve officers could graduate into a full-time position. So it gives us that succession plan starting to be built in our patrol roles, which are our most important roles for the police department. The current adjustment in the salary table that we have proposed for you has no financial fiscal impact in this year's budget. Currently, we have a $19,000 budget, and very few dollars of that has been spent. The officer has been out quite a few times, but at $16 an hour, you're not going to spend $19,000, in the next 3 or 4 months. So we propose that by the time we do the hiring, the training, and adequately prepare somebody to be a level 1 reserve officer, that we would not impact the $19,000 budget, even with our current reserve officer and any one or two or three officers that we bring aboard. So this will bring us to the police officer trainee position. The police officer trainee position would be helpful in allowing us to recruit and attract qualified candidates that want to become police officers. We could then sponsor them after a successful hiring process. We would sponsor them through the police academy, where they would attend the local police academy here in Allen-Hancock, which is about 22 weeks or so long, upon completion of the academy, and they successfully complete the academy, they would then be appointed to a full-time police officer position. The police officer trainee position is a non-sworn police officer position. It does not have the same public safety benefits, such as retirements and so forth. It would be similar in benefit-wise to a miscellaneous position that we currently have, either under the SEIU agreements. The wage would be $23 an hour. That would be a fixed wage for the entire time that they are in that position. And that is a competitive wage. It's actually in comparison to what Pismo Beach is paying their police officer trainee. And it is a few dollars higher an hour than what Santa Maria pays theirs as well. Currently, there would be no fiscal impact due to creation of this position in this budget year, because we have salary savings with the current vacancies that we have. So the police officer trainee position would be, again, $23 an hour or $36.80 a month plus the benefits. Basically, it is my recommendation or staff's recommendation that the City Council receive and file the status report, as well as adopt a resolution establishing a police officer trainee job classification and amending the classification and compensation plan for the reserve police officer salary as well. And I will entertain any questions or comments.
Thank you, Chief. Let's ask questions. Councilmember Nichols, do you have any questions?
Yes. On the police officer trainee, the staff report says you conduct a recruitment process for new full-time officers and sponsor them through the California standards and training post-academy. What would that cost us?
Right now that costs us about the same. It depends on one of the benefits of the police officer trainee is we can actually hire somebody in the early stages of the academy. So the academy cost is about $4,000 to $5,000 for tuition, equipment, and so forth that has to be purchased. And then the staff time that is put into hiring, the process for written tests, background checks, and so forth, those are the same costs that we're incurring right now as we do all the other tests. So it wouldn't be an increase in anything. It would just depend on how far you have to go. Sometimes if you have to take a background investigation to San Jose, there's more cost because you have travel. If it's a localized recruit, then the costs are pretty minimal and we can knock it out even faster.
Okay. So that basically it would be a year before he's fully out in the field on patrol.
Anybody that we hire at this point would be a minimum of about 5 months before they're out on their own.
Okay.
Unless they're a lateral police officer, our minimum training is 10 weeks on that. So mm-hmm. You're still looking at 2.5 months before they would be on their own.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Mayor Pro Tem Lee.
Thank you, Chief, for that that staff report. Does what happens if a candidate is unsuccessful through the academy? Does the city lose that investment of the $4,000 to $5,000, or how does that get reimbursed by someone, or would we just need to transfer that search to another candidate?
We would that the city would be out that investment, the initial investment on that training time. That's why it's important that when we go through the hiring processes, they're pretty extensive, and we want to make sure that that we're going to get the biggest bang for our buck and make sure this individual goes through the academy. That being said, there is those chances that they could fail the academy and they would be released from their position and we would move on to another suitable candidate.
Okay. So which then just begs the question for me. So what is the success rate of having the background check done before the academy versus after the academy when they've successfully come through it? Is that?
Well, it's fairly similar. The issue that we face right now is the best recruits in the academy are getting picked up in the beginning stages of the academy.
Okay.
The recruits that are not getting picked up towards the end of the academy are being passed over because of unsuitable suitable qualifications and background issues sometimes. So what we are currently left with the process that we have in place now is that we can go and recruit from those folks that have not been picked up by other agencies, and you know, some of those folks don't make it through our process.
Okay. So this provides us an opportunity to at least get closer to the front of the line, if not all the way to the front.
It does give us a competitive advantage to be right up there in the beginning and to make that investment of somebody who is high in the scoring.
Okay, great. So then just more of a clarification question. The reserve is a sworn position. The trainee is a non-sworn.
That's correct.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. Questions? Councilmember Bright?
I do. Thank you. Thank you for that report. It was very informative and quite interesting. Although a lot of this stuff we already knew that we need some parity here, but I didn't realize just how much help we need. So a couple of questions. So then regarding the police officer trainee, so while they're not actually actively in training, is the post-training, is that like 8 hours a day?
It depends on the academy. It depends on what their training schedule is.
The one at Hancock.
Most of the times it is 8 hours a day. There are some night classes. There are some adjustments in their schedule throughout the academy. And as part of the contracts and agreements that we would have drawn up, it would be covered that $23 an hour would be, that is your salary that you're going to get. There wouldn't be overtime eligibilities for additional hours. It would be based on the hours that are performed within the academy in order to meet the post standards.
Okay, so that would be while they were attending the post academy. Actually, I want to finish this regarding that the police officer trainee. I imagine, though, that you could probably give some thought to folks that maybe do the pre-academy or something like that and see how they do before you. I imagine you've already thought of all that.
They're actually required now to attend the pre-academy prior to appointment through the full-time academy.
Okay, good. The reserve police officer. So that's a police officer that does not go through the post?
Yes.
Or, okay.
They go through post.
They do.
Yeah.
So can you just explain to me, I'm not getting the difference between reserve and a regular officer.
Okay. Obviously, a regular officer is full-time and completes the academy. A reserve police officer is a dedicated individual, usually somebody who's from the community, and puts themselves through the academy, whether it be the full 664-hour or, in some of these cases, now they're running 700-plus hours in the academy. But they're dedicated enough to put themselves through the academy, and then they want to come to work for the police department in that reserve capacity role. They can work up to 30 hours a week.
So it's part-time?
Correct.
I see. Okay. So we don't go out and recruit really part-time officers?
Yes, we do.
Oh, we do?
Yes.
Okay, so interesting. I did not know that. Okay. Well, that's good to know. I think those are my only questions at this time.
Okay.
Thank
you. Councilmember Shaw.
I just want to thank you for the report. It shed a lot of light on a lot of issues, and I think all my questions were asked and answered, so thanks.
Welcome.
Okay, very good. Mayor Pro Tem Lee had asked a question about the risk of hiring someone in an academy, and I thought you were going to follow this up with, do we know what's the success rate of cadets going through an academy? Trying to identify what really is the real risk in doing that, do you know?
Well, the academy classes can generally start off at about 25, 26 recruits in the very beginning, and they have at times graduated as low as 12. So you could lose a lot, but the academy's been doing a much better job with requiring backgrounds prior to people getting the academy now, and requiring them to go to the pre-academy, so it weeds out people who really don't have that full commitment to the profession. So their success rates have been much higher these last couple of classes. And what we're seeing is that most of the cadets that are coming out of the academy have already attained jobs elsewhere. And I would say probably three-quarters of the class is actually graduating from the academy.
So you said they've already attained jobs already before going into the academy? Is that becoming a standard practice?
Some have, yes. For instance, the city of Santa Maria is hiring a lot of their recruits prior to the academy, but at the same token, they're there on the first week of the academy recruiting. And when it's time to recruit, we send our staff down there, and you can see that Arroyo Grande's been there, Pismo Beach, San Luis Obispo, all the agencies have been there within a matter of a week or two of the academy start, or whenever the academy actually allocates time for those agencies. And it's, for lack of better terms, it's a feeding frenzy. It's the agencies are in there trying to get the best quality candidates. We don't have that ability to do that currently until the very end of the academy. The other agencies that have police trainee positions or have the ability to hire in the academy are doing that at the very beginning.
Fascinating, because the analogy that comes to my mind is college recruiting of athletes, or even in pros, that you can do background checks and talk to them, but that's not a true measure of how they're going to perform once you put them actually out on the street. So,
yeah,
fascinating.
It's
okay.
Just like hiring any person from the street right now that's already certified, even laterals, you're taking a chance and they may not work out.
Well, that's true, but we're not paying for them to go to an academy. So, so you say we currently have one reserve officer. So, what is the standard number of reserve officers for a community of this size, where you got 19 sworn, not all are filled, I understand, and then 9 non-sworn? So, what would you say would be, you know, is it 1, is it 2, is it 3, is it 10%?
When I came here in 2006, we had 4 reserve officers. Most of the police officers that were hired prior to 2006 and were working full-time in our agency all came out of our reserve officer pool. So my goal is to get our department back to the number 4. So we have a sufficient pool of people to choose from. And if we ever experienced a disability retirement or a regular retirement, or somebody moved on to another agency, and we found ourselves in a position of having 3 to 4 openings, we have 3 or 4 people that are ready to jump into those roles.
Okay. And then I have the question I have is, you talked about the comparison of what other agencies are paying reserves. You showed a single line for the city of Arroyo Grande, and you showed a number that I think was about $24, correct? I'm looking at, and I'm just wondering, Arroyo Grande is obviously going to have something similar to level 1, 2, and 3, but I don't see numbers for them in 1, 2, and 3, so I want to get a real sense of what's the true comparison.
They only have level 1 positions.
Is that right?
That's correct. We are one of the only agencies that uses level 2 and 3 in this county.
What are the benefits of having level 1, 2, and 3 versus just one level?
The level 2 and level 3 are your beginning stage police officers. Usually they can be college people that are attending college, and they can go to the modules, the different modules of training. The module training program is becoming more and more non-existent. Most reserve officers are required to go to level 1 training now. So that being said, we did not want to rule out the possibility of having a level 2 or level 3, that we could bring that individual on, get them started to see if it's going to work out. They're committed to go to the next training module on their own, and if they step up through the process and become a level 1, then we can successfully look at moving them into a full-time position eventually.
So Pismo Beach, do they only have level 1? Because I'm seeing...
Yeah, they do the level 1, and that's their pay rate is based off of their full-time officer pay.
Okay, so you can kind of see where I'm having some difficulty here. When you're showing me a proposed level for Grover and then saying this is competitive, when I'm looking at a number and I'm saying, well, why is that top level more than Arroyo Grande when they have – so I'm hoping you can help me reconcile that. So.
Sure. The if we go down through that attachment two, Atascadero does not pay the reserve police officers, and I talked to the chief there. They currently don't have any. Arroyo Grande has level one police officers only, and that is their pay rate from 24 through 28. And it hasn't been raised. That's been the pay rate for quite a few years. So I would suspect that sometime in the future they may see an increase. Of course, you have our rates. Morro Bay doesn't run a reserve officer program. Paso Robles only has level one officers, and they only pay that $32.30 an hour. Pismo Beach only does level one officers, and they start at $31.04, which is their bottom step full-time police officer wage, and it goes up to their top step full-time police officer wage. San Luis Obispo PD doesn't run a program at all, and the San Luis Obispo sheriffs only use level one deputies, and they start at they only pay the $38 wage.
Okay. So let me pivot here. So we have the ability to have 19 sworn officers, but we've got several vacancies now. And I guess it's a sensitive topic for us to discuss since we're already in negotiations, but I think you alluded to it or you mentioned it in your staff report regarding them being out of market. So, Bob, maybe this is for you. You know, I mean, I understand trying to get reserve officers, and I understand raising it to more than minimum wage. I'm having difficulty reconciling why we continue to have level one, two, and three, and the others do not, but I suspect that it's that they're paying officers higher and being able to retain them, but that's just speculation on my part. How much can we discuss in open session, given the fact that we're in negotiations?
Well, Mr. Mayor, let me say that we are under current discussions. A review of the market conditions has been a part of that discussions, and those discussions are ongoing, and the intent thus far is to try and make some movement to bringing those individuals back to market, given our current constraints. I just, if I could, Mr. Mayor, in terms of addressing also the Reserve 1 and 2, simply it has worked for us in the past, because what it's enabled us to do is to bring someone in. The full level one requires a significant amount of training. The level two is not so significant, and what that's allowed us to do is to, for instance, have two individuals in a car at a time, which has been helpful in certain situations. It just provides additional flexibility in both bringing people in and what we're able to do on the street.
So what's the difference? Is there a significant difference between someone that you would bring in at a level one versus I'm going to use regular for lack of a better term, compared to a sworn officer?
The hiring process is exactly the same, but the training requirements for a level three officer, which is the bottom step.
Well, I'm talking about number one.
Level one.
Okay,
level one.
A level one officer would be the same requirements as a full-time academy officer. So a full-time officer, the training requirements would be the same.
Are the same.
Yeah.
Okay.
Maybe I can ask a question. So, but the level one officer is someone who's not a lateral shift. So, but a sworn officer or a non-reserve would have to be a lateral move. Maybe I'm confusing the issue here. So, but I'm seeing if the background analysis is the same for a level one versus a fully sworn officer, right?
Correct.
So the difference is we get to go capture the level one reserve as he's going through the academy. So, or am I confusing the issue again?
I think you're confusing. They're two different positions entirely. The cadet is not a level one. The cadet is simply someone that is in a training program who's being paid a competitive salary for the completion of that training. But still, up until the time that they've completed that training, they do not have the same, they don't meet the same requirements as a level one. The level one has to meet the same requirements as your regular officer. The advantage often of a regular one, just using the fellow that we currently use, he can perform all of the activities of a full officer and operates as one. He prefers to work a full-time other job, and this just is his supplemental profession, if you will. So having the ability to, that helps us just fill in where there are vacancies and needs that we wouldn't otherwise have.
Okay, because I guess in my mind I was thinking if there's no discernible difference between a level one and a regular sworn officer, I think my preference would be just to hire a sworn officer. I don't, you know.
Certainly.
So that gets back to the issue of why three levels, but okay. Final question. What is the decision lie with respect to hiring someone, whether you're hiring them in as a level one, two, or three? Is that a decision made at the administrative level, or does that come back to the council?
That one, two, or three, that hiring is all done at the administrative level.
Okay, so we approve a range, and then
right.
we are not informed until after the fact about...
That's correct. They,
okay.
Just like a normal member of the the classification series.
Okay. And we look forward to figuring out a way to retain our officers we have in-house. I think that's, I mean, this is all fine and dandy, but we need to figure out how do we retain and recruit officers for those vacant positions that you showed on the screen. So... we look forward to having that conversation. Anyway, those are all my questions. This is a regular business item. We don't normally open this up to the public, and I don't see really anyone from the public. So what is the pleasure of the council? Council Majority, what do you want to do? You want to go over your recommendation again? Can you put it on the screen? You don't need to go into a long-winded explanation. Just put it on the screen.
I've got it.
Well, that's okay. Could you put it on the screen for mm-hmm. folks who don't have packets and who might be watching at home? Okay, thank you.
The recommendations, actually, I don't have up on the screen.
No.
Here. There we go. The recommendations would be a creation of the police officer trainee program, as well as the amending the increasing the reserve officer salary. The additional recommendation of relocation and hiring incentives, that's still under discussion for staff.
That's something you bring back to the council at a later date?
If necessary, yes.
Okay.
Okay.
Everyone good?
Yep.
Okay.
I'm ready to make do we want to make a motion? Or?
You have the floor.
Okay. Then that we adopt the resolution establishing a police officer trainee job classification and amend the classification and compensation plan for the job classes of police officer trainee and reserve police officer.
I'll second.
Okay, there's a motion and a second. Is there any additional discussion on that motion? Okay. Martin, is this do we have a resolution in front of us?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, roll call. Roll call vote.
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Okay, let's move on to item number 9, an update regarding the efforts to address vacancy issues. City Manager Peralta, are you going to start the staff report?
Yes, Mr. Mayor, members of the council. As the council is well aware, there has been a recent increase in a population that has contributed to vagrancy issues throughout our community. I want to be very careful in how we define this particular population. in that this is just not a the vagrancy issues are not just related to homelessness. Someone that is homeless by virtue of recently losing their home or current house is home is not necessarily a problem. They are transient in nature, and there are such services that are available. But those that are contributing to the problem are those that I would identify not only as homeless, but they're generally jobless, and they have some other issue associated with their makeup. Ultimately, this has caused an increase in vagrancy issues for the city, and it was recognized by the council. And over a year ago, the council authorized the city to initiate an enforcement program or the development of a program to deal with these vagrancy issues. And some of the issues that we're dealing with, believe it or not, are aggressive animals that are generally in the possession of some of this, some of the population. And it can be in public intoxication, can be panhandling, it can be, fights occasionally breaking out in altercations in different locations. In November of 2014, the city adopted and implemented a aggressive animal ordinance that actually gave us the added tools needed to assist the officers in dealing with aggressive animals. These were issues that we or tools that we didn't have before. I wanted to remind you that obviously this was something we could do very quickly, and it was kind of a first step in the program. The second and more broad program was the aggressive panhandling ordinance, which was introduced in February and became law in March. This essentially prohibited acts of aggressive panhandling, no matter where they occurred throughout the jurisdiction of the city, and also stipulated that or limited the places where panhandling could occur. It essentially eliminated most or a good part of our commercial and downtown areas. Since implementing that ordinance, we have seen an improvement in the situation throughout the downtown core. We have educated business owners as a part of that implementation of that program. And I think we continue to see the benefits today. In February of 2015, we also entered into an agreement with the SCT Transit, the local transit agency that uses Ramona Park. And actually, with their access to grant funds, we put in a first series of cameras that directed our attention, and we had views directly from those cameras into the dispatching centers themselves. It assisted us in the work we've done in Ramona Garden, in cleaning up the Ramona Garden area. In March of 2015, the council authorized additional use of overtime funds for the development of downtown enforcement program, and we've carried that out since its inception. It's both pedestrian and actually just recently it's grown to a bicycle program. Of course, this is dependent, as the chief has indicated, on the availability of officers to make that be successful. We are also working jointly with other agencies in dealing with the large encampments of homeless of this population that we see throughout in various locations of the community. The first and maybe top priority is the encampment just south of town. south of the depot, which we have been working with our partners, state parks, county parks, Union Pacific, in terms of elimination, because we don't believe that's a healthy or a good environment, and we don't believe that, and we do believe that has an impact on the surrounding commercial area. We were able to get that property posted. We did do an initial sweep of the property. The next step for us is actually cleaning the property up. You may have seen that it is in a lot of trash accumulation. We've recently received a bid from a company that we think we'll be able to use to actually complete the trash removal. We're going to be working with our partners to encourage them to participate with us financially in getting that done, possibly fencing the area down there, and also lifting the foliage. We believe that that will eliminate that encampment, and then we will need to move along to the encampment on 4th Street. In addition to, we have also, through additional grant funds, been able to install additional cameras that, again, are able to view the downtown corridor that is within the area of 4th and Grand. And we're going to continue to move the camera program up the corridor. And, in fact, we'll be installing cameras at the corner of 9th and Grand. Sometime in the next month or two. So these are essentially the activities that we've undertaken within the last several months, and we continue to work on the issue per the direction of the council. I can answer any questions you might have. The chief's here as well.
Very good. Thank you, Bob. I see. Councilmember Shaw.
I do have a question. I'm not sure if it's for the chief or the city attorney, but if there are private business owners and they are wanting to keep people off their private property, would it be advisable to place a no trespassing sign? Would that be a first step? Or what would you advise a private business owner with private property to do?
Well, certainly, in order for the city to be able to assist a property owner needs to post no trespassing signs on their property, recognizing, of course, that those signs are equally applicable to all trespassers.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Councilmember Bright.
Thank you. I'm just wondering about, there are several businesses in town where they take donations, and oftentimes people want to just drop these donations off when the business doesn't happen to be open. And I have heard from some of our residents that that does create an issue where you have folks who want to go through the stuff that's been left behind or by the side or whatever of the building. And so I'm just wondering if there is maybe some way that we might be able to encourage those businesses that do take donations to have some kind of a locked, you know, those, like they have on, I think it's, I don't know, 10th or 11th or 12th, one of those streets, one of those numbered streets, you know, where you put the clothes in and it's just in a box where then it's sealed off, I think. So I was just wondering if that might be something that would be a benefit or possible, or
sure.
Well,
thank you, Mark.
Certainly, with your direction, staff can encourage, simply advise them that that would be a good idea. I mean, another approach is if they are a source of trash, for lack of a better word, that is being deposited on the city street, the city certainly has a right to deal with that if it's in the public right-of-way, whether that's by issuing citations or by simply removal. That would obviously be an enforcement step. Mm-hmm. But if that is the direction, and the less drastic approach doesn't achieve the goal. That may be a solution. Also, you know, placing containers, large containers that are locked, that would be shared by maybe two or three places that take such donations, and be someplace in a place that's accessible to the public, might be another solution.
True. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Councilmember Nichols.
I think we've done an amazing job so far with the resources we have. And I think we really need to reach out to the public to partner more with us on reporting incidents, time frame included as possible. I would encourage businesses, particularly like between 9th and 10th, where we have a lot of complaints, and it has this parking area in the back that is an ideal place for the vagrants to hang out. They're not as visible. Put lights up. Light up the night. Make them more visible. And I think we will help. That will help reduce the hanging around. So I would really like to call on the public to partner with us a little bit more diligently, and the businesses as well.
Okay, very good. Mayor Pro Tem.
And I'm going to echo Councilmember Nichols' comments. So that those were very good. I have a question to say, is there a business watch or is there a community watch out there for folks that have stepped forward that your staff is working with? Or has it all been from the city out with business owners stepping up individually or not?
Yes, we have a neighborhood watch programs, which is primarily residential. Business watch program we do not have, but I'm happy to say that the last two Coffee with the Cop programs that we've had, that topic has come up. And I think it's in a general discussion stage right now that it could be a feasibility if the businesses wanted to get together and formulate a watch. The police department would be more than happy to assist them with that, but it has to have, as Councilmember Nichols stated, it has to have their involvement as well, because it won't be successful without everybody's involvement.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. Gotcha. So some of the conversations I've had with folks deal with probably a fairly sensitive question, and I'm hoping that you can kind of address where either the court cases, maybe this is a question for the city attorney, where court cases have, for lack of a better term, emboldened the civil rights of the transient population, not in to jeopardize the private rights of businesses, but has there been a erosion of that? Am I saying that correctly? Or maybe you can give us a kind of a summary of where the legal footing is from the standpoint of the city is right now.
Yeah. Well, I think generally speaking, the overall basic legal footing has remained unchanged, and that is, you know, that people do have a right to be in public places. That's what public places are about. And I think that our tools to prevent people from being in public places, parks, et cetera, are pretty limited. Where not so any more recent changes in the law became very apparent, and Chief and I actually sat through a presentation on this issue at the League of California Cities, I think, is where my former employer, City of Fresno, decided to clean out an area, and what was determined to be trash, the court determined to be private property, which should have been stored, cataloged, and made available for recovery to those who claimed it was theirs. City of Fresno got hit with a verdict somewhere in the range of $2 million for cleaning out one of those types of encampments, for lack of a better word, and sources of a lot of criminal activity, admittingly, and a nuisance, obviously, to the neighborhood. So there's a greater level of awareness among city attorneys and police departments dealing with how do you deal with those type of issues, like cleaning out an encampment or where you have certain people congregating or basically living in a place where there shouldn't be, but still it's established, and what you do with their property once you do remove them. So that's an area where a greater level of consciousness and greater level of attention is being paid by public entities to how they deal with those issues. Anything you would add, Chief?
Yeah, I concur with you. It was at the CJPIA, and it is a critical step that police departments and cities learned from Fresno, losing $2.3 million because it wasn't done appropriately and according to what the law determined. So now we have a lot better procedures and understanding and things that have to be followed, and there's some costs associated with that when municipalities take those measures.
CJPIA, not league. That's right.
Okay.
It was one of those two.
Okay. So thank you for that. And then I guess the next step for me is, like, say there is an issue in a business. So what is your normal protocol if a business owner calls up and says, hey, I've got someone loitering, I'd like them removed? The business owner, I'm assuming, has the right to ask that person to leave, and if not, then they call your staff and.
Yes, generally the business owner, by the time they've called us, they've already probably asked the individual to leave and gotten a negative response. So the officers, when we're called, the officers are sent down there and contact the business owner and determine what the issue is. And if the individual is loitering or is trespassing on the property, the business owner then gives another warning to the individual, asking them to leave in front of the officers. And if the individual fails to comply, the officers provide one additional warning, which is required. And then if that's not heeded, an arrest can be made.
Okay.
So clarification, you mean not loitering, since we don't have a no loitering ordinance, you mean trespassing, or disrupting.
Loitering implies public property generally. Trespassing implies private property. The business owner cannot prevent somebody from standing in front of their business on a public sidewalk. But if they are on their private property, then in the doorstep or in a stairwell or some other place where people tend to sleep or try to shelter from the elements, they are clearly trespassing, and the owner has the ability to gain assistance from the police department to have them removed.
Okay. How often is the perpetrator still there by the time the officer gets there?
Very few times.
Okay. So we don't have a no loitering ordinance. So
there is a loitering in and of itself cannot be prohibited under the law. The city of Fresno, actually, my former partner Larry Donaldson was one of the innovators in this area, put into effect in the early 90s an ordinance which prohibited loitering for purposes of one, prostitution, and the other one was drug transactions. So basically it was kind of an anticipatory conduct, which is very tough to prove in court, but we've won some trials on that issue. But in and of itself, precluding loitering, which means just hanging out in public places, has not been successfully instituted anywhere.
Okay, because I was under the impression that San Luis either had a anti-loitering ordinance or something closely related to it, because I know they've talked about no hanging out on public benches in the downtown for more than 2 hours. So I don't want to get sidetracked. I mean, that's kind of some direction and thoughts I have for later, but I want to kind of get some clarity as I move forward through my questions. So let's see. Business Watch, Neighborhood Watch, thanks for taking that one. The cameras, thanks. Well, first of all, thanks for the report. I think this is information that this council has done quite a few things, and I've contacted some business owners out there to kind of get a sense of what their thoughts were, and some who had said, yeah, there still tends to be some issues, but they feel it's somewhat manageable. So I want to say thanks for moving forward on these, on the measures, whether it was the aggressive dog ordinance or the aggressive panhandling ordinances. So I think that's really moving in a good direction. The cameras at the west end of Grand, I think, makes a lot of sense. So I'm just curious, what is the cost for installation of these cameras?
Well, the last camera project that we had was at in front of Station Grill and at 4th Street, and those cost about $17,000.
Okay.
That also included a wireless mesh network that transmitted the signals back to our police dispatch center. So if you wanted to look at just cameras themselves, they're about $8,000 a pod.
Okay, so the total cost was $17,000 for those two locations.
Correct.
Okay.
We're looking at a different option, though, that we, the same company is trying out a pilot project, and they've chosen us to try it with throughout their Grand Ave corridor. So they're going to try some more stuff that's lower cost but higher quality.
Okay. And, Bob, can you just confirm, you had said 9th and Grand cameras, you said
yes,
within the next month?
Next
or this
2 months.
Month?
Is that?
We actually have tentatively scheduled for December 2nd installation of that camera, as well as several more going down Grand Avenue. That's that pilot test program that will put two additional cameras at every other intersection down to Highway 1.
Okay, and that's 9th and Grand. Great. So let's talk a little bit about the foot and bike patrols along the Grand Avenue corridor. And in the staff report, and Bob, you talked about this, that the downtown patrol has been conducted on a regular ongoing, on a regular basis, but it's dependent upon the availability of officers. So what is regular? What is regular?
Well,
how often?
We try for weekly. And, of course, that depends on the ability to fill with overtime.
So weekly, once a week, on the weekends, on the weekdays?
No, we are putting out six shifts a week for sign-up for the officers.
Okay.
And that's based on the shift times are based on the call load volume and what really impacts Grand Avenue. So there's different times, like on Saturdays, than there would be for Tuesdays. So the commander looks over where the calls for service are the highest, and that's where we aim the shift to go out, so it kind of has that higher impact. And again, it is a, you know, in reference to staffing, if there's, you know, people on their days off that want to sign up and do that detail, they surely can.
So then how do we make this more regular or weekly? I mean, is the reserve program, we just increased the salary, a possible way to do that, and how quickly could you get someone on board?
It is a possibility of doing that, but those police officers, again, will have to go through the full training program. And if they came to us with a state certification already, they still have a 22-week training program through our department.
Okay. And the reason I'm staying on this a little bit is because business owners that I've talked to, and I think we've all talked to them at one time point or another, said that really made a difference having that presence. And so I'm trying to get at, is it regular? Is it inconsistent? Some have said, yeah, it was regular at some point, but it's gotten a little lighter. So I think that's a program that we had initiated that has a ton of potential, and I want to know how we can take the next step with that.
Yeah, when we first launched that program with your assistance, we had only two vacancies at that time. So the additional vacancies have really dug into the patrol corps, and the patrol shifts are what are our primary functions to fill first. And the officers are filling those shifts, and a lot of times with overtime. So they're working, you know, 12 hours of overtime on their days off. And we're getting to a honestly, we're getting to an area where we're getting burnt out on some of the staff.
Yeah, so. And we certainly don't want that to happen, but we need to figure out a way to, how do we take the next step?
I think as we fill these positions, and hopefully we can get attraction of lateral candidates that would have a shorter training period, but as we fill these positions, you will see that the foot patrol and the new bike patrol will go out on a more regular basis.
Okay. Okay. I had a couple other things and questions. It's really some discussion for us to have. But thank you, Chief, and City Manager for that staff report. And I think it's important for the community, although no one's here, I'm sure others will watch on TV, to know that these items have not fallen through the cracks, and we're trying to address them, and certainly government has limitations as to what it can do. And I appreciate the council members bringing up the issue of no trespassing signs and whatever we can do to certainly not infringe on someone's rights in this country. But I think by the same token, we really need to figure out how do we get to a level of, I don't know if it's no tolerance, but certainly a level in which folks feel safe to conduct business in this community. So thanks for bringing this. This is a report for us to receive and file, and I think the time may be appropriate. Is what I'm thinking of the council members is, I'm almost wondering if it's time to maybe call a meeting with the business community to get business owners and property owners to in a meeting to discuss the items we did tonight, and then to talk about some other ideas that we can figure out how do we work in a collaborative manner. Because I think we've all said that government is limited in what we can do, especially when you're talking about things occurring on private property. But I think there may be some opportunity. Here's a question for you, Bob. Maybe you can answer this. With the vacant positions, will there be some savings between now and the end of the fiscal year?
Certainly. It'll depend on how long those positions are vacant for.
Okay. So I don't know if we need to place something on the agenda, City Attorney, or if we can just get a consensus to give staff direction to try and organize a meeting with property owners and business owners on the Grand Avenue corridor.
Well, I think if the intent is to have council participate in that meeting, I think it's a workshop. And that means basically a notice meeting and a workshop. And then it's certainly your ability to direct staff today to set that date, consistent with your calendars, or direct staff to basically contact you with dates and have that date based on your availability. It's not a Brown Act violation. You can all be polled with regard to when to set a meeting for.
Great.
So you can either do it now, or you can direct staff to contact you and find some available dates based on staff's availability as well. Obviously, the noticing period to the property owners and their availability, business hours need to be probably considered, and all of those things that come into play with trying to bring people in here who during the day work running their businesses.
Okay. Is there a consensus from the council to do something like that?
Absolutely. Yes.
So then we'll give staff direction that we do want to have a workshop with business owners and property owners on the Grand Avenue corridor, and then staff will coordinate and try and find a date and time that works for the council, as well as certainly as many of the business/property owners as possible.
I would like to maybe not just limit it to the Grand Avenue corridor, because I know we had one speaker, I want to say she had a business on Front Street, or there are
point.
People in other areas, maybe any business owner willing to attend.
Fair enough.
Yeah, that makes good sense.
Yep.
I think we have the city I'm expecting has a business license list so that we can draw from. So as a kind of almost notification tool, and then also working through the whether it's the chamber groups or some other business groups that happen to be in town.
Yeah, I would say those combinations. Okay.
And Mayor and council members, just to be clear, I mean, if it generally would be the process of organizing this type of an event is through simply a general notification, not a singular business owner notification. In other words, the moment we start trying to notice some of the business owners, we by definition exclude others, and that obviously creates problems. I'm not sure that your direction is to contact every business owner in the city, because that's also has its issues and cost prohibitions. But so generally speaking, we advertise it on the website. We talk about it. We talk it up and contact the chamber or other organizations that can spread the word.
Yeah, have the chamber put it in their newsletter or something.
Exactly.
Okay.
Mr. Mayor, if I could,
yes.
Timing. Is there a timing you'd like to see this workshop held with in?
A month or a week or a day? I know we're getting close to the holiday season. Right. Any general thoughts?
I think before the holidays, if we could.
I would only say that I think the chamber is their newsletter is a good method of reaching their members, at least. I would just suggest that we do it sometime after their next newsletter goes out, so that provides a certain means of notification.
Do we know how often their newsletter goes out?
It's monthly. I just don't know exactly what the date.
So then I would suggest you check the date, and maybe if it's has to be December, maybe it's the second week of December, somewhere thereabouts. That gets us off of a council date and gets us out of earlier than Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think that's the time frame. How's that? Everyone okay with that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let's move on.
Mr. Mayor, if I could.
Yes.
Could I request a 5-minute break?
Okay, let's take a 5-minute break.
Thanks.
You guys need to let us know these things. City Council meeting, I think at last we had finished up item number 9. So let's move on to item number 10, which is consideration of a fair share payment plan agreement for the deferral of sewer impact fees associated with the hotel project located at 950 El Camino Real. City Manager, are you doing the staff report?
I'm going to do the staff
report. You're doing this brief staff report. Very good.
Mr. Mayor, members of the council, as you introduced, this is a recommendation regarding a fair share payment program for sewer impact fee deferral associated with the hotel project located over on El Camino Real. This project has been in the making for a long time. It's a 132-room hotel project located at 950 El Camino Real. It's actually a part of your economic development goals and work tasks is to facilitate this project because it'll add to, obviously, our lodging inventory and will also generate funds through the collection of the transient occupancy tax that will go directly into the general fund. The project has not been without its challenges, as the council is aware. There have been a number of water and sewer infrastructure constraints associated with this project. Ultimately, the project had to be running a water line completely up El Camino Real to Oak Park. In addition to that, for sewer, it's connecting a long-term, a long lateral to the Nacimiento lift station. In order to facilitate this project, we've already undertaken a number of actions. One is a deferral of impact fees. It's something that we could do administratively. State law provides us the opportunity that we can defer those impact fees until occupancy rather than collecting them at building permit time. So we're doing this with this project, and this will assist with getting the project underway. We've also made an adjustment to the traffic impact fee. It's similar to the actions we're taking relative to the lodge, and we've seen that traffic impact fee be reduced by about $294,000 based on a trip recalculation, daily trip recalculation formula. We're also agreeing to reimburse the developer for oversizing costs associated with the water line that will eventually serve additional development once that development comes on board. That still leaves us with the issue of the sewer problem. Essentially, it was brought to our attention with the long lateral. We needed to see what kind of impact the sewer would have from the Nacimiento lift station, the hotel would have from the Nacimiento lift station on our normal sewer lines. First of all, a little bit of background. The sewer master plan was prepared in 2006, but unfortunately, it did not contemplate this hotel. And subsequently, it didn't look at the line serviced by the hotel. And also subsequently, the impact fees that were developed as a result of that sewer plan didn't take into account the location of the hotel. So we proceeded to have an assessment done by GTA. That's the assessment that has been attached in your report. And the assessment basically takes a look at the impacts of the hotel and calculates its fair share. And those impacts are, again, on our existing collection system and estimates the costs of sewer mains that need to be replaced as a result. The sewer study's conclusion is that there are downstream impacts. Technically, as you read from the report, a sewer line is considered at capacity at roughly running 50% of the pipe. That is to allow, obviously, for the ability to accommodate peak flows. When the sewer master plan was done back in 2006, it, however, recommended and identified that, yes, while a 50% capacity full pipe means that at some point it's going to be, need to be replaced, but that may not happen for a number of years. So consequently, the sewer master plan took a look at really needing to replace pipes at, when they were at 65% of capacity. Taking this analysis into account, there are four pipe segments that are impacted by the hotel. And by impacted, that means that at full build-out, they will be in excess of the 65% capacity. The various different segments are identified here, the costs associated with the replacement of those segments by the hotel, segments that will be impacted by the hotel, indicates with a total cost responsibility for the hotel of $251,712. In looking at the chart that you have in your staff report, I don't have it up here, but what it indicates is that one segment needs to be replaced because it's presently running well above 65%, and I believe it's actually closer to 70% at the present time. And so what we're recommending is that the developer would be responsible for replacing that particular segment, or at least their portion of that segment. They would do the work now because they'll be doing other sewer infrastructure work, and it just makes sense to have them do that. We will reimburse them for costs that are other than the developer's responsibility. For instance, the ratepayers will bear a part of this responsibility for the existing line as well as future development. And that would mean that you'd be decreasing the $251,000 that is the overall responsibility of the developer to the $194,615. Staff is recommending that we work out a payment plan that would allow the developer to pay these remaining costs over a 15-year period. Amounts to about $12,000-$15,000 per year, using our investment life rate plus a 2% interest rate that would come into account. And any kind of a loan, even at this level, would require some kind of security. So essentially, staff is recommending that the council authorize staff to proceed with the development of a fair share payment plan that would be reflected in agreement with the terms as outlined here and in the staff report. So that concludes my presentation. I'm certainly available, as well as is the Community Development Director and the Public Works Director, if you have any questions.
Thank you, Bob. Mayor Pro Tem Lee, you have any questions?
Sure. Thank you. I had a couple questions. I see on the dais a letter from Urban Commons saying that they're supporting the deferral of the sewer impact fees associated with the hotel project on 950 El Camino. So that talks about the impact fees. Are they in agreement with the
repayment?
The reconstruction as well?
Yes.
Okay. So then the next question I have is the lines that are showing the need for reconstruction, which are, it looks like, P15, 16, 22, and 23?
The four, but not all at this time.
Okay, maybe I'm misunderstanding that then. So which ones are
P22 is the one that needs to be done immediately.
Immediately, and that's the only one that...
That's the only one that will be in excess of 65% at the time that the hotel opens. The rest of these will not reach that capacity over a number of years, but certainly will at build-out.
Okay, so the which lines are going to be reconstructed by Urban Commons?
P22.
Just that one?
Just that one.
Okay. Okay. So, and it looks like, according to that summary, it's a 10-inch line between South 4th and Manhattan. Is that correct?
Yes.
And so what size line does that go to? Does that get upsized to a 12?
Greg?
Yeah, that's actually a pretty good question. I don't, I'd have to dig through the report to see, but my estimation would be from an existing 10, yeah, probably.
The next,
yeah, I don't think it actually shows in the study necessarily what the upsize capacity, but I think it's reasonable to expect that would be a 12 to 16, somewhere in that
range.
Okay,
yeah, the next size pipe downstream of that P23 is a 12-inch. So.
Yeah, so we wouldn't exceed that capacity. No.
Okay. So.
Well, actually, P23 is shown for future upgrade, too, so we actually might. We might actually exceed the size of the pipe downstream, which would be a little unusual, but, you know, and then at some point in time, P23 would be improved also.
Okay, so we've got the one piece of pipe that the developer is agreeing to upsize, P22. Okay. So now the deferral of the other, and so that is the $57,104.
That's their portion of the total cost of that replacement.
Okay.
Total cost is $162,800. Their share of that is $57,104.
Okay. So, but the so then the remainder, which is the $194,615. They end up deferring payment of those fees until occupancy.
No, and let me clarify that. There are two sets of fees. The fees that we're dealing with here are the fees that were in addition to the development impact fees, because the way the development impact fees were constructed, this hotel wasn't taken into account.
Right.
So there needed to be a way to address the specific impacts of the hotel on these specific lines.
And maybe I think this may assist you, because I think I understand your dilemma. These are impact fees that obviously would otherwise be used for construction of these lines should the need arise. So the deferral of these fees would mean that those amounts, if a need arose to have P15 done prior to the city receiving all that money, that funding would have to be sourced out of some city revenue while the reimbursement is being paid, should a need arise to have those development impact fees pay for those upgrades.
Okay. I guess I'm still struggling with, okay, so we've got four lines that need to be upgraded as soon as, effectively, as part of this development of the hotel at full build-out. So only one of which needs to be
done now.
Okay. The other lines are anticipated to be upgraded in the future. The share of the impacts from the hotel is being calculated into what otherwise would be their development impact fee for a sewer But again, those fees were not calculated when the study was done, so they're being calculated now.
Right. Okay. So in the resolution, it says their fair share amount is the $251,719.
Right.
And so the participation of $57,104, depending upon the installation of that piece, leaves them a balance of $194,615.
Right.
So when is that due and payable to the
city? That would be otherwise due and payable right now. But what the decision is before the council is to defer or to spread the payment of those fees over the next 15 years.
Over the next 15 years. Okay.
In the meantime, should the need arise to build these lines, the city would have to backfill that $194,000 from some source that would otherwise be in that fund. So the deferral of these fees or spreading these fees over the next 15 years could necessitate the city having to backfill it while it's getting paid. It's a loan, basically, okay. For lack of a better
gotcha.
Word.
Okay. Sorry, I, my brain was thick on that one. I apologize. So my last question is that one piece of pipe, the P22, plans are approved? Obviously not, because we don't know what size the pipe is yet.
Right.
So if we approve this evening, what is left remaining for ground construction to continue at the hotel site?
They would be able to move ahead immediately with construction of the project and all the off-site public infrastructure that's been approved. This would need to be designed by their engineer and go through plan check. But you've got, I think they said, 16 months before they would be opening. So we feel confident that they can design it, get it approved and constructed in far less than 16 months.
And as the community development director indicated, the initiation of work on the project is not dependent on completing this particular segment.
Okay.
Councilmember Nichols, do you have any questions?
Not at this time.
Okay. Customer Shaw.
We talked about how the money will be deferred and we'll be getting around 12, I think it's 12,000 a year. Do we have any way, and I understand what the city attorney laid out, that at times we may be loaning money out of our funds to cover pipes. Do we have any estimate or guesstimate as to when these major pipe constructions will happen and how, when the city may be outlaying money or?
No. I mean, if you look at this study, which was a targeted study, I mean, certainly we know that by 2035, the construction would be necessary. Could we exceed, do we expect to exceed a recommended pipe flow before that time? Sure, probably, you know, but specifically when, we don't know. So staff's recommendation is relative to another item has been discussed previously, and that is a citywide sewer master plan update, which would also include flow monitoring throughout the city. And then with that study, we would have a better grasp on pipe flows throughout the system, as well as a better, we would be better able to anticipate when we should expect these pipes to be replaced. So,
because we're
lacking
was,
on information a little bit right now.
That was kind of, you really segued well into my other question, because we read this report from Gehring and Taylor, I think it was, that kind of giving us some of the pipe flows and the estimates, but my question was, how will we keep monitoring that on an ongoing basis? So if we go for, because, I mean, I know I would not want to be caught with this stuff much over percentages and not knowing it. I think that would be the worst-case scenario. So when you say flow monitoring, is that something you'll put on the pipes that will be able to tell us on an ongoing basis, or will this be every few years we hire a company to do this flow monitoring?
I anticipate two versions of that. One is that as we update the sewer master plan, we would actually install flow monitors in manholes, which is what we did for this project, actually right near City Hall here, as a matter of fact. So we would actually install flow monitors for a period of time, take those readings, and then remove them. And then, knowing citywide pipe segments where we anticipated flows to exceed 65-70%, we would simply, in our normal sewer maintenance program, we can look down in the manholes and determine pipe what has been the pipe depth, just based on looking at the walls of the pipe and the manhole itself. So we can look and say, hey, there's a manhole that appears to be coming up quite a ways beyond what we expected. Now we know we've got to get on, we have the next 6 months or so or a year to get to proceed with construction on that pipe.
And is this what you're talking about sounds very reasonable and necessary. Is this a plan that's done going forward? Is this something we need to approve, or is this going to happen? Gosh, when I see numbers like 2035, I just think, well, none of us are going to be here, and you guys are going to be here, and I want to make sure that this we have a plan that this is done and we don't have pipes overflowing.
The answer to that is probably twofold, Mr. Mayor. It is, we will do periodic monitoring, but in addition to that, we really need to do a sewer master plan update. It's been talked about before. I'll be bringing back the first quarter report, and we'll be talking about goals and work priorities, and that will be a time to start looking at that. And then those kinds of updates should be done at regular intervals. I would suggest every 5 years, actually.
Okay. That sounds like a great plan. The only thing I had, and I went over it with Bob, is in reading the resolution, as long as everyone agrees, I understand what the intent of the paragraph is, the now, therefore, be it resolved paragraph. To me, it read it in a little bit of a confusing manner. I understand what we're intending to say. I just, as long as everyone agrees, that's what it says. Because when I read the, especially the second, I guess it's the second sentence, the resulting balance shall be payable over a 15-year period. In my mind, that would be 2051-719 minus 194-615, which I know is not what's intended, but that's just what I got from the balance. But I know that Martin and Bob put
The word is two, not by.
Oh, okay.
Right in front of that number, if that word was by 194, then that would be a subtraction. But it is two.
Okay. Okay. As long as everyone knows I'm good with it, I just needed everyone else to be good with it.
We may be. We'll see. Well, we're not that far yet, so okay. Thank you.
That's all. Any I have. Questions? Thank you.
Karen, you have questions?
I don't at the moment. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Where to begin? So I'm going to go all the way to page 4, where you talk about other options considered. And can you clarify for me where you say staff also considered the use of wastewater operating reserves. These funds will be appropriately used to cover the ratepayer share of the sewer main replacements, but cannot be used to fund impacts associated with future development.
Usually operating funds, and I'm talking about the operating sewer enterprise operating funds specifically. Those are developed based on rates, and those are supposed to include the responsibility for all major replacements, improvements in the system that you really can't assign to anybody else. So realistically, as these lines are improved, The dollars that would be coming out of the capital reserve in the collection system would be the ratepayers' share of that portion.
Okay. So we updated the land use element and zoning, but we didn't go far enough and update the master water and sewer plans, correct? So if we had done that in a timely manner, would we be having the same conversation? Because this is not the only property down there with development potential.
No. If we had an update sewer master plan, we would be having a different discussion.
Okay. So basically, the fact that we have a project in front of us and we cannot move fast enough on updating a water master plan and the sewer master plan means that this is staff's best effort to help facilitate this project.
Yes, and the reason for that is if that sewer master plan had been done and had been updated, it would have reflected the condition of these pipes and would have identified what that residual amount should have been due to the developer. With the absence of that plan, our whole intent here was to be fair to the developer, but ensure that developer would only pay for his impact on the system.
Okay, so if we move forward with this, how would staff recommend someone coming on property that's closer to Manorock and AJ Spurs would be contemplating a similar project? How do we address that? Because I imagine that would have some effect on downstream pipe sizing.
Well, I'll ask the city engineer to help me out with this, but at least the spot analysis that we've done will help to a degree with that, because it also has identified not only what this developer is to pay, but what future development should pay in that would be contributing to that same line. Is that absolutely precise? Probably not. The sewer master plan probably would assist with that, but it would be more of a dollar calculation rather than having to reinvent all of this again, I would think.
So has Urban Commons identified a potential start date on this project? Because it's interesting. I hear that they have all the permits they need. I don't know if that's true. And if they do, then do we know why they're not moving forward? Do they have any intention of moving forward any time in the very near future? Does anyone know?
Their issue right now is currently getting loan approval from their lender. They've been, like any business, they've been shopping loans. They've actually arrived, I believe, at a local bank finally. They're waiting for that term sheet to come from that bank. They expected that this week. It would still take potentially another 30 or 60 days for them to close and get funded. However, there is also the possibility once they know that the loan will occur that they could then restart construction at the project site, self-funding temporarily until the actual loan proceeds are available.
Okay. So, I mean, I don't want it to go I don't want staff or anyone to take to think that I'm not appreciative of you making this effort to work with this particular applicant. But I will say when I read page one and you talk about incentives and you have three bullets, you talk about deferral of payment of all impact fees except fire. I'm not sure why not fire until occupancy of the hotel. I think that is something that's a common practice, and I think that's good. But the recalculation of traffic impact fees based on actual trip generation of the project, to me, is not an incentive. That's a best practice. And then indicating the city's willingness to enter into a reimbursement agreement, you know, I mean, obviously we're here because we didn't update the master water and sewer plans, and I think we're going to have to figure out how to reconcile that. But if this is the best we can do for now, I'm okay with it. But I, you know, we got to get serious about if we're going to really try and do economic development and find things that are tangible that we actually do have resources to tackle. And so when I see potential segments on the screen and know that we have a potential source, you're telling me the only reason we can't do this in a comprehensive fashion is we don't have an updated master sewer and water plan, correct? Well, I don't know. I'm not sure if I'm looking for a legal opinion or a technical opinion.
Well, I think there's two steps in this process. There is identifying all the infrastructure that will be necessary to serve build out in the community, and that will be done in the sewer master plan. Then you now have a list of all of the public infrastructure that needs to be improved. Then the next step is to go out and update our development impact fees, which will then create basically what this did in a limited amount and assign the fair share to all new development, whether that's a hotel project or anything else. And then you wouldn't have this step because we would then simply go to the development impact fees that have been adopted and assign it based on the use. So, and you know, it will be a real comprehensive update of our development impact fees. One of the reasons, as an example of this adjustment for a traffic fee, those last two items that actually you mentioned, Mayor Scholes, are really more of an adjustment to their pro forma because they went in this with thinking that the traffic impact fee was quoted as the commercial rate, and you've kind of heard a little bit of this discussion in the law just because our development impact fees are inadequate. We don't have enough categories to properly categorize the type of use. Those will all be resolved with a development impact fee update.
Okay, and City Attorney? Yes.
Thank you, Honorable Mayor, Council members. The legal part of this that I wanted to point out to the Council is even if the scenario just described by the Director was in place and there were development impact fees already established for this project, they would either be due and payable at issuance of COs or this item would be before you just like it is right now with the developer asking for
relief from
relief and a payment over time of those impact fees.
Okay. To be continued.
Can I interject a question into there before you go forward? Is we've got the cost allocation for the hotel on the screen. Basically, P22 is an item that is earmarked for construction by the hotel. So is there a reason why the city doesn't undertake those that work and defer all of this payment over
That was a question that I was going to ask. Thank you for bringing that up.
Certainly that's an option. You mean to have the city go ahead and do P22. The only reason that we discussed doing it with the hotel operator is that currently it's just a matter of time and work, and we thought that the developer in this case might be in a better position to ensure, number one, he's motivated to ensure that work gets done prior to occupancy.
Okay. And I guess my potential response to that would be looking at the 4th Street. That looks like a street that, and I don't remember if it's been 3 years or 5 years ago, that we basically improved. And so we're basically going to be putting a sewer trench right down our new street.
4th Street? No. The sewer will actually be going through the open space area, if I'm not mistaken, under the creek to Nacimiento.
Not on that segment.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, on P22 is on 4th between Manhattan and Seabright. And so I guess my second thought there is and I haven't looked back through to check to see if we've got a waterline improvement along that same stretch. If we end up basically combining the plans and I'm hearing a plan check process through the city process where if we do it then it kind of reduces the the plan check process because it's our own process.
Mr. Buckingham.
Well, if the city takes it on as a capital improvement project, we then need to RFP for a design engineer, hire somebody, and go through that process. So in discussions with the developer, I think they agreed that they felt they could expedite the project by controlling it, because they just go out and hire their engineer to design it. They will then contract with their contractor, and though the contractor will have to construct at a prevailing wage, they won't be subject to our typical bureaucracy in order to hire and procure
bidding process.
So.
So that, you know, the next progression of the question is, could they do that and then we reimburse them 100%? But I'm going to let that lay. I'm going to leave that alone because I think that's a bigger discussion. I think this is, given where we are, it's a fair way to proceed, and it looks like Urban Commons actually is in agreement with what is being recommended. Okay. So with that said, anyone prepared to make a motion on this item?
I will, except for the fact that I've lost my spot. So if someone else is ready.
It is recommended. I move that it is recommended that the City Council adopt the resolution authorizing the fair share payment plan and agreement with Urban Commons for the deferral of sewer impact fees associated with the hotel project on El Camino Real.
I'll second that.
Okay. Is there any discussion on the motion? Oh, with the amendment to the resolution that you had mentioned earlier, the motion maker and the second okay with that?
Yes.
And Martin, do you want to read what that is just so we're all clear?
In the second to the last sentence of the now therefore be resolved, it will read the resulting balance of 194,615 shall be payable.
Okay, very good. You guys okay with that?
Yes.
Okay, roll call.
Yes.
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 Yes. So what I'm thinking is, and see what the council members think, is item 11 is the status report regarding capital improvement projects. Bob, is that something we can go through quickly, or maybe that's something if the council is okay, we can continue this to the next meeting?
Actually, I would suggest that we go ahead and continue it. There isn't much in the way of updates right here.
Okay.
And we can certainly do that.
Okay.
The only note I would take is that we did look at extensively at 13th Street. We have since made the modifications that had been discussed. And given that direction to Santec for incorporation with 15-2, our purpose in only having it here was for you to take another look at it.
Okay, but you don't have that tonight, correct?
Well, we do have that one attachment, but other than that, and the purpose of that was just to make sure we are still in line with what you wanted to do, and I believe that's attachment 2.
You said attachment 2?
Yes. Yeah.
Sorry.
To the staff report. Maybe you don't have it for some reason.
I do not. Yes, I do. Yeah, sorry. It's late. Okay, and everyone else has taken a look at this and...
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you, Bob.
All right.
If I can indulge one question on the lodge. sorry, that I'm sorry, it was actually on the attachment number 3, which was the Grover Beach Transit Station expansion.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some discussion in there that staff is going to be beginning lease negotiations.
Yes.
Okay. And I'm just wondering if now is appropriate time or at another location to determine whether there's an opportunity to include either a rental car company or some other adventure amenity into those lease discussions.
I don't know that that would necessarily be something that if you're talking about the lease agreement would be entered into between the city and UP,
right,
and the city and county parks.
So, and I guess maybe the question becomes is can we ensure or there hopefully there won't be any anticipated preclusion of uses on that site ancillary to the train depot or to the expansion? I'm sorry.
Bruce?
Yes, there are some limitations, in fact. Specifically, when the project went through the environmental review, Caltrans was very concerned about trip generation at that time. And so in order to facilitate the approval of the project, we basically agreed that there would be no new trips generated by this project. It's just the transfer of the bus station to the site south of the existing depot. However, there is a vacant area of land that could have potential future uses, but that would facilitate its own coastal development permit and entitlement process. And so I think I believe at the time the thinking was get the project constructed with the grant funding, and then the city could then contemplate, again, that would be some negotiation back with the county as far as the use. You could try to integrate that into the lease discussion with the county at this time, not being able to identify the specific use, but at least acknowledging or that there could be some revenue generating use in the future.
Okay.
And I would add that we've actually been contacted by somebody that has some interest potentially in the future use of that property as well. So I think we can talk about this. We actually did receive a lease proposal from Union Pacific today, and so we'll be bringing that to the council in closed session for a discussion, or at least negotiation discussion.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So attachment 2 doesn't show the treatment at Grand and 13, so maybe that's something you can update us on at another time.
Yes.
Okay. So I think for the most part, then we'll look for a more robust report on that at the next meeting. We don't have any pool consent agenda items. And how about on council committee reports? Do anyone have anything that you just absolutely have to report tonight?
I have some. Oops.
Okay.
But I have to. So you go.
Barbara?
Nothing I have to.
Okay, I do have something. So South County Sanitation District, even though there's a meeting on Wednesday, I did want to let everyone know that at the last board meeting that the board decided to move forward with putting future billing on the county tax rolls. So there is a very involved process that would occur that needs to take place, and so there has been a consulting firm that they've been working with. So initially it's going to be $10,000 to get that information into the system. They then have to, I believe the deadline is, I want to say August 10th, for it to be on the next year's tax rolls. So next time I'll bring you a lot more of the details of that. One of the things that also was decided was that in the interim, that we pursue agreements with each of the three entities, and the formula that was suggested was a base fee of $15,000 and 25 cents per customer, which gets us seems to be closer in line with what the city's costs are now. So that was, I think, communicated to the city manager, correct,
yes.
Bob?
Did yes, you Mr. Mayor. Mm-hmm. And actually, I can support that because it's very close to the parameters that the council established. The $15,000 was reasonably the same, almost the exact same amount that we had reached in our formula. The 25 cents per account comes a lot closer to covering the overhead that was in addition to our base fee. So we're going to be essentially made whole with that formula.
Okay. So I just wanted to make sure that you were all aware, because I believe that may be coming to us on Wednesday. Okay.
So just a logistical question there. So if the agreements are established with each city,
The two cities
and the
service
district. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So would the pursuit of the county agreement not continue, or would it still continue?
I think right now it's the idea is that it would continue because the formula, even with each of the agencies, is still significantly higher or substantially higher than what the county would charge. I still think there's some complicated things to work through with putting this on the tax roll, because you're really talking about what someone being billed twice a year rather than monthly. You're talking about property owners now having a bigger responsibility, and how would that affect those who own apartment buildings versus so they would have the responsibility. And if someone does not pay their bills for a period of time, let's say 3 to 5 years or so, the county does have the ability to move to the next step, which is basically not just a lien, but moving to foreclosure. Mm-hmm. So, I know.
I think that's a huge mistake.
I know. But I think the thought was that this has become such a contentious issue between, and I would say I'm very proud of this council and this community, because being the representative, I really feel like a lot of times I'm in between trying to find what's the fair and equitable solution and to reach some common decisions that so we can move forward. So this has really been a emotional, contentious item that has really stalled this board from moving forward on some of the other very positive things that we're trying to accomplish. So I think as more information comes forward, there may be a reconsideration of this, so stay tuned. I'll let you know. Okay. And the only other thing that was decided was to move forward with the rate study and a 218 protest hearing, and I believe that would be January 20th, 2016. So just those two small things. Hmm. Fun stuff. Anyway, thanks, everyone, for being willing to hold over your committee reports. Any council communications? Okay.
I just, the Chamber of Commerce is looking for nominations for the Citizen of the Year. So think about that. And also nominations for the Tally Award for contributions in youth in South County. And just, I know we all know about this, but I wanted to announce that there is a Housing Trust Fund workshop at 3 p.m. on Thursday, open to officials and I think members of the public too that want to learn more about the Housing Trust Fund and hopefully more about affordable housing and getting more going in this county. So I'm going to try to go on our behalf. So
okay. Anyone else?
I have something that I would like to put out to the public in our city and the council. On November 11, there's a program, America Shines a Light on Veterans, and their Walmart happens to be sponsoring change your outdoor lighting to green bulbs for that day to show our support of veterans. And I would really like to see that
November 11th
in our city.
That'd be great. I think we can do that. Very good.
Okay.
Green bulbs.
I saw that. Will Walmart give us the green bulbs?
They'll sell them to you, yes. I'm sure they have a whole stock ordered. I think you'd find them a little bit difficult to find them elsewhere.
Okay, very good. So the only thing I'll say, this was given the council packet and the letter that we had written to Caltrans. I think this was brought up by Mr. Weisong, and District Director Tim Gubbins wrote a very nice response back to myself, and I believe this was distributed to the council on Friday.
Yes.
Right. Bob, would you please share this with Mr. Weisong?
Yes.
Thank you. So let's move on.
We announce many of us are going to a lunch tomorrow for one of our own citizens. Clifford Clark is getting an award. I don't know if someone can elaborate exactly what it is. But it is an award for all of his charitable work.
Where is that at?
Madonna Inn tomorrow.
Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm. So, City Manager, are these two items we need to discuss now, or can we push these over to the next meeting?
The only thing I can tell you is that I was hoping to talk a little bit about the water special meeting. Next regular council meeting is going to have a number of issues on it, and I was hoping that the council might take a look at adding another meeting between now and December 1st, if possible. So we could handle those water items. I know that schedule is difficult, but you know, one thing to keep in mind is the 30th is an extra Monday, so you have three Mondays between meetings.
Okay. How does everyone feel about the 30th? That's after Thanksgiving.
Right.
I think that'd be all right. All right for me, I think.
Okay.
Okay.
Works for me.
All right.
And we can bring the other one back at the next meeting.
Okay, very good.
Yes.
Okay. So, City Attorney, can you have any reports or comments?
Actually, before we
leave. None here. Thank you, Mayor.
Okay.
Just a quick question for the special meeting starting at 6:30?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Great. Thank you, Jeff. Can you cover closed session items tonight, City Attorney?
Certainly. Honorable Mayor, Council members, it's the intent of the Council tonight to meet in closed session on three items. Two of them pertain to labor negotiations with all represented groups. The last one is session with property negotiators pertaining to Pacifica companies.
Okay. With that, we were assessing a closed session.